Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
This the city of Chicago.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. Yesterday, the Chicago Defender, one of the most important black publications in U.S. history, ended its print run. And starting today, it will only publish its content online. This marks a significant change for one of the most historic papers in the United States. For over 100 years, the Chicago Defender told the untold stories of Chicago's black community. But this transition to digital only is a sharp turn for much of the paper's audience and an especially sad transition for people who relied on physical copies of the paper. Joining us to discuss all this is Richard Prince, a columnist for Journalisms on Diversity Issues in the News Business. Welcome to The Takeaway, Richard.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And also joining us to discuss is Shea Taiafemohajer, professor of the University of Southern California and a media criticism writer for the Columbia Journalism Review. Welcome to the show, Shea.
Thanks so much for having me.
Richard, let's start a bit with the historical context of The Defender. Tell us about its backstory. Why did the paper form initially, and what was its importance in the community?
Well, its importance is, they're a towering example of the power of the black press in the 20th century, particularly in the earlier part of the 20th century. It was largely responsible for the great migration of African Americans from the South to the North. In that era, blacks were still being oppressed, and they were getting really tired of it. And the Chicago Defender, Robert Abbott, the publisher and editor, said, "Come on up to Chicago. We have jobs here. You don't have to take that." And they listened. And the white power structure in the South tried to keep blacks down there, but they were not successful. Some stayed, of course, but Chicago became a mecca. And for that alone, it earned a spot in history. But there was more, of course, as with the rest of the black press. There was still a lot of Jim Crow and discrimination to be fought. And over both World Wars, World Wars I and II, they inaugurated what they called the Double V campaign, which was victory at home and victory abroad, meaning we must fight racism in the United States, but also in the armed forces itself. And as a result of some of that, there were people in the federal government who were investigating these black papers for sedition, thinking that that was tantamount to treason in some cases. So the black press and the Chicago Defender played a major role in keeping African Americans' eyes on the prize. They would cover issues of concern to the black community that were not being covered in the segregated white press, and that continues to this day, although a major change took place with the civil rights movement and integration and the beginning of the white press and white media to hire African Americans, which sort of sapped the brain trust of the black press.
Shea, I want to make sure we get in. When you heard that the Defender was going digital only, how common is that for particularly for ethnic press today?
I think ethnic press really struggles in a lot of ways. One being legitimacy. They're often disrespected and told they're advocates simply because they focus on a community so strongly that they are deemed to be one-sided rather than, you know, given the props that they are deeply service-oriented to communities that have been neglected by American journalism.
Shay, I want to get back to what we were just talking about in the last segment here. When you look at how digital media is sort of taking over, we've seen this happen across media in general, but specifically for Black press and ethnic press, what are some of the main challenges when they shift to digital only?
I think digital only is a different conversation. It's a younger conversation, and it can be very heated and demand a lot of time. A breaking news focus is often what is needed when you're covering news in a digital space. You can't be late to it. And unfortunately, I think there's, you know, folks who often produce ethnic media in addition to doing other jobs. Not, you know, at the Defender, but in many places, you'll find that, you know, these are very, very small mom and pop shops that are, you know, doing something out of the goodness of their hearts. And that isn't always putting them in a position to compete on big stories or to produce journalism that's a little deeper.
Richard, I want to also take a step back. We've, in addition to the Chicago Defender, we've seen Johnson Publishing, the historical publishing house of magazines like Ebony and Jet Magazine. When we look at the state of Black media in the United States, what's your sense of where it is today? Is there room to be concerned for the future of Black media in the country?
Well, I think Black media has the platforms have shifted. When you say Black media these days, you're not really just talking about Black newspapers. You're talking about the digital space. You're talking about television. You're talking about radio. And those platforms are thriving. BET is huge. Whenever they put on an award show, it just goes to the top of the ratings. That's Black media as well. We still have Black radio stations. And as I said, the Black digital space with websites such as The Root and The Griot and HuffPost, Black Voices, are all attuned to breaking news and are places where people tune in to find out what's the latest thing that's going on. And we can't, of course, forget Black Twitter and social media, which also has become a part of Black media. So the Black newspaper media have sort of fallen behind and therefore are really an older or state audience, I guess. So when you talk about Black media, you're really talking about social media and the digital space and television and radio.
I'd love to get both of your thoughts on how what's happening behind the scenes a lot of these organizations is also shifting. When we think about newspapers, it used to be, you know, ad revenue is what drove most of that, whether it was a small local press or even the New York Times. That revenue model has obviously shifted. And we're also seeing a decrease in the number of media companies that own. Who owns what is really a big conversation. I think we've seen less people of color, less Black Americans owning media. So I'm curious whether you see that affecting Black and ethnic media more broadly, Shea and or Richard.
I mean, I see that there's always a struggle in media in terms of, you know, revenue. But I do see, as Richard notes, the success of some sites to really adapt to social media. I think the big story of social media is that there's always been an audience. Movements like Black Lives Matter, Me Too, Close the Camps, these are all in their own way indictments on the coverage plans of journalists across this country who weren't covering Black people dying, who weren't covering sexual assault and all these stories in the ways that we're finding out there now. So in terms of revenue, I think that is the never-ending struggle. Content and choices and coverage are where I think we're seeing a real shift in digital, and people are finding success where they were told those aren't even stories.
And this has come up, Richard, I'm not sure if you're familiar with this, but this has come up a lot, particularly with Latino-owned media here in New York. When we think about the one of the longest-serving publications, El Diario, has had changes in its ownership. And we see shifts in the type of content that El Diario is producing, from less substantive content especially. So does that have an impact also? Who owns the media, Richard?
Yes, it does have an impact. In fact, I wrote a piece a few years ago about this very question of who owns what. And I think that the response I got from editors of these of the publications that are not owned by people of color is, look, as long as they leave me alone to do what I need to do and give me the resources, I'm fine. And that seems to be the approach. Univision, of course, is the biggest Hispanic-oriented television network, and that's not Latino-owned.
And it's up for sale. Or it's talking sale, about right. being up for sale, so we'll
yes.
see. Yeah,
exactly. And Telemundo, of course, is owned by NBC. But I don't hear the grumbling that they're not doing what they should be doing because apparently the people who are in charge of the content are allowed pretty much to do what they think is best. And as long as you bring in those dollars, whoever owns it is happy.
Shea, you live or you're based in Los Angeles. Give us a sense of are there local outlets speaking directly to communities of color there? Are there smaller ethnic publications that are thriving where out on the West Coast?
We do have some independent media out here that's doing a great job. I shout out LA Taco every chance I get. I think they're doing some exceptional work. But I mean, a lot of the work that I've done recently in Los Angeles looks at the newspapers we lost. The Chicago Defender, in that same era, we had the Liberator out here in Los Angeles, and it disappeared for many, many years and was only recently unearthed and is at the California African American Museum now as a sort of historical display. But we look back and we also see what we've lost. There have been newspapers that have come and gone. KSCI was a channel out here that only had broadcast for pay-for-play, where international groups would go and host Armenian language or Cantonese or Farsi language television shows for immigrant communities. And we lost that last year. So a lot of these smaller publications that serve immigrants and that serve communities that are, you know, rather large here in Los Angeles struggle to stay open, stay up.
Shea Taiafimo-Hajer is a professor at the University of Southern California and a media criticism writer for the Columbia Journalism Review. And Richard Prince is a columnist for Journalisms focusing on diversity issues in the news business. Shea and Richard, thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
North Carolina.
Durham has lost a legend. Acclaimed architect Phil Freelon died yesterday at the age of 66. He was diagnosed with ALS in 2016, and the state of things spoke to him after his diagnosis.
You try and figure out what is the new normal going to be. And we decided early on that it wasn't in our nature as a couple or as individuals to retreat into some shell and pretend or, you know, to hide the truth.
Phil Freelon will be remembered around the country for his work on the Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture. In North Carolina, he left his architectural footprint on public spaces throughout the Triangle. Joining us with a remembrance is WUNC race and culture reporter Leonida Inge. Leonida, welcome.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
So tell us a bit about Phil Freelon and the architectural footprint that he left here.
Well, it's a large, a large footprint. He's known for working hard to definitely bring design to previously neglected places. I think that was in his heart. And like his colleagues have said, and, you know, he wanted to kind of give people a sense of dignified belonging. So a lot of the things that we see every day, we may not know that Phil Freelon played a part in actually making that a very special place, like even the I call it the bus depot, the downtown Durham bus depot. I noticed it was when I first saw it several years ago, I was like, that's really classy.
Well, yeah, we have the bus depot. We have Terminal 2 at RDU.
Yes.
There are plenty of spaces.
We have the Durham Bulls ballpark. A friend called me this morning to remind me that, you know, even the Stone Center at UNC Chapel Hill, a lot of his work is at universities, especially historically black colleges and universities.
Tell us about his diagnosis and how he lived after this diagnosis of ALS.
Well, you know, when he was diagnosed in 2016, he decided early, he and his family, to be very public. He said, you know, in a way, at work, he was walking slow, moving differently. He almost couldn't hide it anyway. You know, people could see that he was struggling. So they became very public, and not in just the sense that we're going to treat this and work as hard as we can to make his life as comfortable as possible. No, they wanted to make everybody's life as comfortable as possible. They wanted to raise money for research, you know, for the Duke ALS clinic there. And they did that.
And they have also been intentional about celebrating his legacy. As things move forward, the family started this North Star Church of the Arts. Can you tell us a bit about it and how his legacy will live on through that?
Well, many people may know that his wife is Nina Freelon, a Grammy-nominated jazz artist that we enjoy hearing often. And so their love of the arts together, they came together and came up with this great idea for the North Star Church of the Arts. It's in Durham. It's on West Gear Street. It's actually a former church, actually. It's a church building, very quaint and beautiful, small, and they renovated it, and they sort of just made it a space for everybody. You know, they say for poets and artists to perform. It's a place of all faiths, and of course, the people of no faith at all can go there. But it's a special place for people to perform and to meet and greet each other. And I really enjoyed when I went for the opening. You know, Phil Freelon was there. He was in this this large wheelchair. He looked great. His smile was big. And I'm glad he could be a part, and his family, to make sure he could be a part of that great last effort that he was able to give the community.
Wonderful. Well, there's plenty more to talk about, and you have a lot of it in your obituary, which people can find at our website, stateofthings.org. Leonida Inge is WUNC's race and Southern culture reporter. Thanks so much, Leonida.
Thank you.
Just ahead, we will talk about mental health in minority communities. You're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio.
I even told people that back when Clarence Thomas was being appointed to the Supreme Court. Say, man, that's a stone, Tommy. Everybody, I said, but you didn't have nothing to do with him being there, one thing, and you ain't going to have nothing to do with him leaving. And if you do have something to do with it, they'll replace him in 5 minutes if they want to. They don't have to go through you and ask you nothing. If they want Clarence Thomas to be your spokesperson, that's what he's going to be. And ain't nothing you can do about it unless you can deal with them.
And there's an interesting dynamic on the U.S. Supreme Court. 9 people often disagree, but then try to meld their views into majority decisions. One justice, though, stands out for his views and his disdain for prior court rulings. Clarence Thomas is the longest-serving member of the current court, and it's only African-American. He will enter his 29th term on the court this fall. NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg takes a look at Thomas's role in the term that just wrapped up.
Talk to court watchers about Clarence Thomas, and the words they use to describe his views are idiosyncratic, eccentric, provocative, probing, and yes, wacky. Yale Law Professor Akhil Amar.
He's gone through all sorts of different ideologies in his life. In law school, he was a Black Panther type, Black Power extremist of a certain sort. Now he defines the right wing on the United States Supreme Court.
As he has in terms gone by, Thomas has charted a course that is at times breathtakingly different from his colleagues. While he wrote 8 majority opinions for the court this term, it was his 18 dissenting and concurring opinions that raised eyebrows. He dissented when the court invalidated the conviction of a Black man tried 6 times for the same crime by the same prosecutor with juries that were either all white or nearly all white. He argued that the Constitution's ban on establishment of religion does not apply to the states. In other words, that the states are free to prefer or endorse one religion over another. He twice called on the court to reverse its abortion decisions, in one case linking birth control and Planned Parenthood to the eugenics movement of a century ago. For the first time, he called for overturning the 1963 landmark decision requiring that criminal defendants too poor to pay for a lawyer be provided an attorney. In another first, he called for overturning a 1964 landmark free press decision that established standards to make it more difficult for public figures to sue for libel without proof of a knowing falsehood. Thomas's newfound objection to the decision was not joined by any other justice, but it does coincide with President Trump's views.
I'm going to open up our libel laws so when they write purposely negative and horrible and false articles, we can sue them and win lots of money.
That was Trump at a Fort Worth, Texas rally in 2016. As a private citizen, he repeatedly and unsuccessfully tried to sue his media critics. Trump has been particularly solicitous of Justice Thomas and his wife, Ginny, who is a vocal conservative activist. The Thomases dined with the Trumps at the White House this year. Soon after, Ginny Thomas led a group of fellow social conservatives in a one-hour meeting with Trump. The Trump-Thomas relationship may have been responsible for retirement rumors fueled by some conservatives who apparently wanted the 71-year-old Thomas to step down so that Trump could replace him with a younger conservative able to serve for 30 or 40 more years. If that was the plan, it didn't work, as Thomas made clear during an interview at Pepperdine University.
As well, let's fast forward to 20 years from now at your retirement party.
I'm not.
No, you're not going to argue with me.
No, but I'm not retiring.
20 years?
No.
30 years?
No.
After each of Thomas's 28 years on the court, analysts have offered different theories about his jurisprudence. Brooklyn College professor Corey Robin has a book coming out this fall contending that Thomas's overriding legal philosophy stems from his views as a black nationalist.
The way I understand Thomas is that he believes that the American state in particular is imbued with race and racial consciousness, and he thinks it's kind of a fool's errand to try to change that.
Thomas's dissent in this term's jury discrimination case would fit right into that category. His solution to white prosecutors discriminating against black jurors is to allow similar discrimination by defense lawyers against white jurors, too. An entirely different view comes from Professor Ralph Rossum of Claremont McKenna College, author of another book about Thomas. Rossum says that Thomas disdains prior Supreme Court rulings because they get him further and further away from the original Constitution.
If you have a finely wrought piece of furniture and you put layer after layer of paint on it, pretty soon all the detail is lost under the coats of paint. And what Thomas wants to do is scrape back to bare wood to the original text.
But even the man who made originalism popular, the late Justice Antonin Scalia, did not have such a purist view. Unlike Thomas, Scalia did believe in precedent. As he famously put it, "I'm an originalist, but I'm not a nut." University of Baltimore law professor Garrett Epps sees Thomas' unique views as arrogant. As an example, he points to a Thomas opinion in which the justice referred to James Madison's views on separation of church and state as, quote, extreme, and said that, quote, in any event, the views of one man do not establish the original meaning of the First Amendment religion clauses.
Wait a minute. You just called James Madison, the father of the Bill of Rights, you just called him an extremist, particularly in the area of religious freedom, which is the area he is most identified with.
Epps maintains that if you read Clarence Thomas's jurisprudence, the views of only one man count.
Thomas alone knows the original meaning of these provisions, and even Madison, who wrote them, can be disregarded. Now, that takes a level of confidence or megalomania that I find really breathtaking.
It is, however, important not to dismiss Clarence Thomas's views. Yale's Professor Amar acknowledges that Thomas has not written many high-profile majority opinions for the court.
If you think that the measure of a success of a justice is how many majority opinions he writes, well, then Thomas ranks somewhat lower. But if instead the game is scored by how many new ideas someone gets into the conversation and eventually wins on, well, then Thomas is way high in the pecking order.
Indeed, if the new Supreme Court conservative majority begins rethinking lots of long-held precedents, it may be Thomas leading the way. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
Okay, Gus, I'd like to call to tell you thanks, man. I've been drinking a whole bunch of water. I lost a lot of weight, and I've been eating a lot of fresh fruits and vegetables. And thank you so much, man. I've been drinking a lot of water.
We all love a fizzy drink or ice-cold fruit juice to cool us down in the hot weather. But are they, in fact, causing us more harm than good? New research from French scientists who followed more than 100,000 people for 5 years found drinking sugary drinks may cause cancer. Dietitian Nicola Ludham-Rain says habits might have to change.
What we need to stress is that the study didn't show a causal link, it showed an association. So we've known for a while now that drinking too much sugar isn't good for our health. And this just adds to the body of evidence that ideally we should be drinking water or second best the diet alternative.
So how concerned should we be? Here's our health correspondent, James Gallagher.
This is a study looking specifically at the sugar content of drinks, and they followed 100,000 people, recorded how much sugary drinks they were drinking, and then how many cases of cancer that turned up later. And it showed that the more sugary drinks people drank, the greater the rate of cancer. Now, what it doesn't tell you is whether sugary drinks are the problem or not, or if it's something else that's going on. Because all this has done is it's discovered a pattern, it's not an explanation. So it could be that, yes, sugar in drinks might be leading to higher rates of cancer, or it could be that there's something about the type of person that drinks a lot of sugary drinks has other things going on in their life. Maybe they eat more, they exercise less. And actually, the sugary drinks are completely incidental. So the next stage in this research is really figuring out what exactly is going on here.
And when we say sugary drinks, this was everything from cola through to what? Fruit juice?
Yeah, so anything in a can that goes when you open it, it counts. But also, if you stir sugar into your tea or coffee, that would count. If you have a milkshake or, you know, those milk drinks that have added sugars put in, and also fruit juice. So it's really focusing in on sugar content. It doesn't really matter in what form it's arriving. And so they also looked at artificial sweeteners, but found no relationship there. So it's really pinning it on the sugar.
And how significant was the increase in likelihood of getting cancer?
Okay, so on average in the study, people were drinking around about 100 mils of these sugary drinks a day. So that would be maybe a sugary coffee a day or maybe a couple of cans of cola a week. I mean, that's the kind of average. And that was leading to 22 cases of cancer for every 1,000 people over the course of 5 years. Now, if you were to increase the amount of sugar those people were drinking, say double it, take it up to the 4 cans of cola a week, then that would lead to an extra 4 cases of cancer. But the thing that we know is that people drink a hell of a lot more than that. Well, I've got friends that will drink a 2-litre bottle of cola over the course of every single day of their lives. I mean, there are people who drink huge amounts of these sugary drinks. But the study doesn't really look at those kind of like extreme consumers to see if there's anything different in those people.
Our health correspondent, James Gallagher.
Maybe we ought to give the kids some
ice cream.
Ice cream? You like ice cream?
Yeah.
Ice cream. Ice cream.
People throughout the country are getting caught licking tubs of ice cream and then placing it back on the shelves. And they could be facing some serious lengthy prison sentences as a result of doing this. Now, this story came up involving a young girl in Texas. She's underage, so her identity hasn't been revealed. But there has been footage, which has been viewed more than 11 million times, showing this girl running her tongue across the ice cream, then laughing as she places the violated dessert back in the freezer at a Walmart in Lufkin, Texas. So we're going to show you the video real quick, okay? And then we're going to discuss what the penalty should be.
Contrivance.
Lick it, lick it. Oh, you foul. Put it back. Put it back. Put it back. Put it back. Oh, you're a...
Okay. Mm-hmm. I'm amused at the guy in the background is like, put it back. Put it back.
No.
earlier her boyfriend was encouraging her and apparently was yelling, lick it, lick it. But I originally misread it and I thought he was going, lick, 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 lick. I was like, what, does he watch TYT?
Put it back.
Tick, 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 tick. Okay, yeah.
Now here's the issue though, all right? Seems like it was just a prank. It was gross, you shouldn't do it, but before police knew the girl's identity, they said that she could face a second degree felony charge of tampering with a consumer product, which comes with a 2 to 20 year prison term and up to $10,000 in fines. And that's according to the Texas State Penal Code.
So a couple of reasons for this. So this sounds extreme. She's not really gonna get 20 years, okay? But she might get a lengthy sentence.
She's a minor, so that's why there was that caveat of before police knew the girl's identity. So as a minor, she will be treated as a juvenile and probably will not face 20 years in prison.
But her boyfriend's also in trouble, even though he didn't do it. They're like, well, he encouraged her.
Put it back, put it back.
Lick it, lick it, lick it. Put it back, put it back.
And he's an adult.
Yeah, and he's an adult, so et cetera. So why, I mean, if you licked a person, you'd probably get less jail time. Why is it set that way? For two reasons. One is historical. Back in the day, people messed with the Tylenol and that created a panic in the country. And so that was a real danger. And so now the second reason is because messing with people's money, especially corporate money, is a much bigger offense than messing with actual human beings. Mm. So if you, like now Bluebell's gonna have issues selling their ice cream. So they're gonna bring the full weight of the law on you. And you're gonna get ice creamed, if you will. Okay, one creamed, of the worst.
Creamed is a very uncomfortable word. I just don't.
Well,
I don't
that's
like
true.
Creamed,
that's true.
But
I thought you were gonna say it was an uncomfortable joke, which is also true.
Yeah, that is true. But last week we presented a story to you all about how a judge in New Jersey did not want to prosecute a 16-year-old rapist. I mean, he filmed himself raping someone.
And then said that it was rape in the explanation of the video.
Yeah, in the video he referred to what he was doing as rape. Now the judge didn't want to prosecute him as an adult, which look is a separate debate. I've talked about that before. I think it's a legitimate debate. But he didn't want to go after this rapist too aggressively because he came from a good family. So you have this insane justice system where literal rapists get the benefit of the doubt, and then you have, you know, a young person doing something stupid, I'll admit, possibly facing 20 years in prison for licking a tub of ice cream and putting it back on the shelf. Like, come on.
Okay, now I want to get back to the fun part. So that's the, you know, depressing irony of the situation.
I apologize.
Okay, now, but why, guys? Why? People are like dying to be famous. So cops are looking for the person who licked it initially, right? And a whole bunch of people raise their hand and goes, it was me. It was me. And then there's a woman who has a very similar name and also has an account and says, yeah, I really did that. You can call it the Bluebell ice cream now because I was a little sick last week. Repost yourself doing this. Let's see if we can start an epidemic, literally. Well, and the cops come, they're like, oh, I guess this is it. This is the person. They're going to go in 2 to 20 years. And she's like, oh, I was just playing. Why? Why did you do that?
And there were others. There were others who tried to take credit for this. But then eventually the cops were able to find the right person who actually committed this crime. Now look, it's gross. It's gross. You don't do that. Come on. I mean, it's ice cream. Everyone should be able to enjoy it. It's one of the few pleasures left in life. You're gonna rob us of that? So I do believe that it is a bit of a crime, but not worth 20 years or even any time behind bars. Like maybe community service, maybe you've got to churn some fresh ice cream for the masses. I don't know.
Come here, Susie. You remember me? Your daddy's friend, Henry?
No, don't.
We return now to the Epstein case, which has brought renewed attention to sex trafficking in the U.S. Lisa Desjardins explores the scope of the problem.
Thanks, Judy. Sex trafficking is a crime that happens across the country in cases that don't usually receive this much attention from the media. Here to explain this troubling criminal underground is Yasmin Vafa. She's executive director of Rights for Girls, a human rights group dedicated to ending violence against young women and girls. Thank you for joining us. Let's start, first of all, with this Epstein case. His lawyers are saying that their client believed these girls were over 18 years old. And also, they are saying that this was not child trafficking. trafficking because, in their words, there was no coercion and there was no violence. I want to ask you, you're also an attorney. Legally, what is child trafficking?
So under the federal law, there is no need to show force, fraud, or coercion when it comes to the issue of minors. Under the federal law, anyone who recruits, patronizes, solicits a minor under the age of 18 for the purposes of a commercial sex act can be found guilty of trafficking. A commercial sex act is actually really broadly defined under the federal law. It encompasses any sex act that's exchanged for anything of value. So under the facts of this case as alleged, it could absolutely constitute a federal anti-trafficking case.
I think I want to get at something deeper that might be going on here with this idea of what is trafficking or who are the victims. In this case, we saw a man who his friends even joked about that he liked young girls. I'm wondering how much of this is in plain sight, the problem of child trafficking. How much of this is a cultural kind of ignorance or shrugging off of a serious problem?
What's unique about this case is the sheer amount of attention that it's getting, but it's not unique in the dynamics that are alleged. We know that men who are powerful, who have an enormous amount of privilege, exploit the vulnerabilities of young women and girls every day here and throughout the country. What's interesting about this case is that it's getting an unbelievable amount of attention, but from our work on the ground, there are individuals much like Jeffrey Epstein, who are extraordinary, wealthy, and powerful businessmen. Many of them are actually white men who use that power and privilege to exploit vulnerable young women and girls. One of the things about this case is that there seems to have been a pattern of targeting incredibly marginalized young women, girls who were runaways, girls who had experienced unstable homes, maybe even girls from the foster care system. And that is consistent with what we see in the young women that we work with here locally.
I think people sometimes imagine child sex trafficking happening in other places to other girls, not girls that they know. How are these girls being lured in these cases, especially so adults can be aware of the risks?
Well, one of the most important things to recognize is that in the United States, the vast majority of sex trafficking cases actually involve American citizens. From the federal data, we know that upwards of 80% of all confirmed sex trafficking cases involve U.S. citizens, and up to 40% of those cases involve the sale of children. And so it's an incredibly important American problem and one that's happening in communities all throughout the country. I think that one of the things that we're hoping comes to light and that people are able to connect the dots between the Epstein case and child sex trafficking all across this nation is that it's often very powerful men with means taking advantage of the vulnerabilities of some of our most marginalized young women and girls, oftentimes kids who've experienced extreme childhood sexual abuse, kids who are from the child welfare system, runaways and homeless youth, and exploiting their vulnerabilities. It's actually a tactic that exploiters use because they know that these are the kids that no one really cares about. They know that these are the kids who most often fall through the cracks, and that even if they do come forward, they are the kids who are least likely to be believed.
Part of the problem is, of course, all of this is in the shadows, and these are vulnerable kids who no one else is looking for them. But what do we know about how prevalent this is in America today? What do you know from your experience?
So what's difficult about this issue and quantifying it is that it is largely hidden. Some of the challenges are the fact that it is mischaracterized oftentimes as adult prostitution. Oftentimes law enforcement and other first responders don't actually correctly identify this as child sex trafficking. And so we don't have exact numbers about the issue, but I can tell you locally here in D.C., with our partners on the ground that serve trafficked youth on a day-to-day basis, we're seeing about 5 to 8 unique referrals per week of children who
are
being
individuals.
Individuals, yes. And between the ages of anywhere from 10 years old to 17, 18 years old. In D.C., one of the providers called Courtney's House actually has 3 11-year-olds that they're serving currently. So it's incredibly pervasive, and the sheer amount of violence and degradation that these young children experience is unbelievable.
Thank you for talking about this very important topic. The executive director of Rights for Girls, that's Rights Number 4 Girls, Yasmin Vafa.
Thank you for having me.
And people won't be asking for jobs, being determined that they're going to get jobs and going to get an education. No, everybody can start getting high on marijuana. because somebody said it's medicinal and it's legal.
What about?
So we better beware.
What about the people who say the legalization of marijuana is fighting against racism because you have so many black people who are unjustly incarcerated as a result of racist enforcement of these drug laws? So this would be a good thing, and it would keep black people out of greater confinement.
No, we can do it by stop using and selling drugs to one another. See, if I'm not using drugs, then I can't be incarcerated for drugs. And I see so many males, young males in my practice who have become psychotic, almost never to return to normal from marijuana use because you don't know what's in it. You don't know how it's been genetically altered. Again, everything has to be put in the context of a power dynamic system of racism, white supremacy. That's one thing the president spoke of, looking at behavior in context.
All this week, we are looking at the impact of the wave of marijuana legalization. One of the key questions is whether marijuana is generally more potent now and whether that poses an increased health risk for some people. It's also coming amid debates surrounding the larger benefits and risks of marijuana. For our Leading Edge segment, Miles O'Brien sifts through the science around what's known and not known about these claims. It's part of a close look at the green rush around the country.
For connoisseurs of cannabis, these are heady times indeed.
It's pretty much like Toys R Us for adults now.
We caught up with Levon at a Jam dispensary in Leicester, Massachusetts. He had just bought some cannabis oil and a pre-rolled joint.
No one really gets in trouble with this, so you know, it's nice not being hassled and things like that just for smoking weed.
The state is among 11 and the District of Columbia that have legalized recreational use of marijuana for those 21 and older.
Can't complain there one bit. Looking forward to enjoying this when I get home.
Massachusetts is among 47 states that have sanctioned cannabis for medical purposes as well. It's a stark contrast from the days of reefer madness, the war on drugs, and the vilification of a plant that humans have used for more than 2,500 years. Precious little of it informed by research.
What an insult it will be to what we are and whence we came if we do not rise up together in defiance against this cancer of drugs.
It was much more motivated by socio-political pressures, if you will. Not a ton of real scientific data. A lot of assumptions were made.
Neuroscientist Stacey Gruber is an associate professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School and director of the Marijuana Investigations for Neuroscientific Discovery Program at McLean Hospital. She has been studying how cannabis affects the human brain for more than two decades.
We're still playing catch-up in terms of trying to understand what we really need to understand about cannabis and cannabinoids and how they work.
She's doing her best to fill the gaps of understanding by imaging the brains of teens and emerging adults, some heavy cannabis users who started very young, and others who are weed-free. When they conduct cognitive tests, their brains look very different. They use different regions to get the job done.
These patterns of activation suggest there's really something different in the way they're processing the information.
The data suggests that heavy recreational use of cannabis during adolescence and emerging adulthood inhibits the development of the prefrontal cortex, the decision-making center of the brain. And Gruber also reports evidence of changes in the white matter, which connects various regions of the brain. The white matter in pot users is less organized and coherent. These individuals also self-report more impulsive behavior.
We know some things, for sure. We know that there are likely negative effects if cannabis becomes a regular part of one's routine when we're neurodevelopmentally vulnerable. That is, we're just still growing up. We're under construction or half-baked, better way to put it.
And the pot is much stronger than it was a generation ago, when it contained, on average, about 5% THC, the psychoactive main ingredient in marijuana. Today, the plants themselves have been bred to be much more potent, 12% THC on average. Strains over 20% are widely available. But that is still not enough for Dario and his friends. They frequently use highly concentrated cannabis products known as shatter, oil, and wax, with average THC levels of more than 50%, up to 80%, and even higher. They prefer the concentrates in part because they get more buzz for their buck.
The high is a little different, I would say, and you definitely get like higher off of the oil, which is enjoyable for sure.
But what are the consequences of this high test high? The data is scant.
Do they simply use less of a more potent product to get the same effect? And some studies have actually reported that, and some others have reported not so much. So I think that's a type of investigation I'd very much like to see done.
Important, but right now impossible. Despite the trend toward legalization by the states, marijuana is still classified by the federal government as a Schedule I drug, meaning it supposedly has no currently accepted medical use and a high potential for abuse. This makes it very difficult for researchers to do their work legally. Cannabis used in scientific studies must be acquired from a government-sanctioned grow site at the University of Mississippi. And it only produces flower, not the high-concentrate products. There is an urgent need to do this science. Dost Unger is chief of the Psychotic Disorders Division at McLean Hospital.
Research is showing that if you're smoking weed that is high in THC, the odds of developing a psychotic disorder are higher than if you're smoking weed that's low in THC. There's a lot of compelling evidence, but it's not necessarily final.
They're seeking clues by studying the way our nervous system interacts with cannabis. The internal wiring that regulates our perceptions and thoughts is not continuous. The nerve ends are called neurons, the gaps, synapses. The electrical current is transmitted across the synapses by chemical messengers called neurotransmitters. Our bodies naturally produce cannabinoids to help regulate the flow of these neurotransmitters.
So when somebody smokes cannabis, you're actually introducing chemicals that can hijack that system that's controlling brain chemistry. It appears that during some critical period in brain development, cannabis has this effect on the brain that actually disrupts normal functioning and predisposes people to a psychotic disorder, whereas in your 30s, it doesn't have the same effect.
In all of this research, it's difficult, if not impossible, to tease apart cause and effect. Does cannabis trigger these disorders, or do people with these problems gravitate toward the drug? And no one has taken a look at the implications of long-term recreational cannabis use on the fully formed adult brain. But recently, Stacey Gruber has taken a look at medical marijuana among adults, and she has some surprising conclusions.
We're seeing improvements in cognitive performance, specifically on tasks requiring executive function. We're also seeing improvements in clinical state. So significantly lower levels of depressive symptoms after only 3 months. And really important, we've seen some very striking decreases in the use of conventional medications.
Benefits, as opposed to the detriments she has documented in young people using pot heavily to just get high. Steve Mandely is a regular medical marijuana user.
Much better.
In 2004, while serving in the Army in Iraq, he got in an accident that left him with an excruciating back injury and a long list of prescription painkillers.
Over a 10-year period, I'd taken 57 different medications, 9 different opioids. I believe in 2009, I was just getting on to fentanyl. I did 6 years on fentanyl, oxycodone for my chronic pain and then breakthrough pain.
It was a struggle, but he finally weaned himself off of opioids and now relies mostly on medical marijuana, which, unlike those prescription painkillers, has never caused an overdose death. But government studies show 9% of those who use marijuana will become dependent on the drug, much better than alcohol at about 23% or cocaine, 21%, but it is not risk-free. Steve Mandely is well aware of all of this, but remains convinced cannabis has made nearly every aspect of his life better.
Every person suffering deserves a choice. And let's stop looking at this as the initial idea back in the 30s, where this is something that's terrible, it's going to ruin the world. Let's get past all the stigma. Let's focus on the facts.
Once vilified, but now moving into the mainstream, cannabis is neither totally bad nor completely benign. It turns out weed is as much about shades of gray as it is green. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Miles O'Brien in Boston.
Well, just in the nick of time came Samuel Colt, who in 1836 invented the first weapon ever that could be fired over and over without having to reload. And all the samurais were like, yee-haw! But it was too late. The North soon won the Civil War and the slaves were freed. Yep, they were free now to go chop all the old master's heads off. And everybody was like, oh no, we're gonna die. But the freed slaves took no revenge. They just wanted to live in peace. But you couldn't convince the white people of this. So they formed the Ku Klux Klan. And in 1871, the same year the Klan became an illegal terrorist organization, another group was founded, the National Rifle Association. Soon politicians passed one of the first gun laws, making it illegal for any black person to own one.
The National African American Gun Association was founded for black gun owners who wanted an alternative to the NRA. Now, some people, including its national president, want that group to get more involved in political and social issues, especially those issues involving black gun owners and police. Others in the organization worry that the move could bring unnecessary and unwarranted scrutiny. NPR's Brakton Booker has the story, and a warning to listeners, this story does have the sound of gunfire.
At a gun range in Midtown Atlanta, Philip Smith gives me tips on what to do before firing a weapon.
The object when you shoot is to be relaxed.
Right. Tell me the gun you're shooting at.
I just have a Smith & Wesson 38. My favorite is my Glock, but I don't have my Glock 19 today, so we're shooting a good old-fashioned revolver.
He locks in on his target, 15 feet away, steadies, and fires. Smith is the founder and president of the National African American Gun Association, but says he's a novice shot at best.
If I had to grade myself from A, B, C, or D, I'd probably give myself maybe a C, C plus. There's definitely room for improvement.
Becoming a sharpshooter is not why Smith created this organization. It started in 2015 so black gun owners could learn about firearms and for members to come together, Smith says, to shoot comfortably. Another reason it formed? To change the image of what it means to be black and carry a gun.
Black folks in guns usually get a negative stereotype reaction, like, what is that guy doing with a gun? My job, and it's a very long-term wish, is to change that socialization process. Where people see a black guy or a black woman walking with a gun, they will automatically say, oh, he or she is a thug, or he or she is doing something illegal.
Membership spiked after President Trump was sworn into office. Smith attributes some of that growth to a political climate where racist views went from America's fringes to the mainstream. The group now has 75 chapters, including ones in Albuquerque, Buffalo, and Tallahassee.
I was surprised, and I was really surprised, and I'm still surprised to this day. More black women are joining than black men.
But what about that name, though? Some members call it NAG. Others, like Smith himself, say all the letters in the acronym, N-A-A-G-A.
I tell you, when I started the organization, just the name itself, I mean, people had a problem with the term NAGA. Some people thought it was offensive. I thought it was, and still do, think it's kind of an edge to it.
Whatever you make of the name, Smith says NAGA has got to be more than just edge. He wants the organization to form a political action committee. It will raise money, perhaps back candidates, but the PAC would primarily tackle issues related to black gun owners. Think Philando Castile, who was killed by police at a traffic stop in Minnesota in 2016, or the incident in Alabama last Thanksgiving. That's when a black man with a gun was helping others get to safety after someone else began shooting at a mall. Police killed Emantic Bradford, thinking he was the shooter. He wasn't.
Does law enforcement or, more importantly, larger society view black men with firearms in a certain way? Let's have that discussion. That's a hard discussion. But it's a discussion that we need as an organization to be involved with.
Very, very.
In a sunlit lounge area at the gun range, a handful of members agree to chat. We talk about deadly incidents involving police and African Americans, the recent mass shooting in Virginia Beach, and white nationalism in the Trump era. But it's when I ask members if the organization should speak out on social issues where not everyone was in agreement. Take 23-year-old Cassandra Light. She's skeptical of the move.
One of the main things that we are trying to do is change the perspective of black gun ownership into a positive mindset.
She says guns in the hands of black people is still seen as taboo, even though Black Panthers and the Deacons of Defense and others pushed for black Americans to arm themselves for protection decades ago. Light worries a shift to political and social issues might be seen as radical, and the unwanted attention might drive members away.
I think if the organization wants to maintain the openness that we have, we also need to be careful about having a political stance, because it's real easy for that to get blown out of proportion and for that narrative to change. And I would hate to see that happen.
Michael Doyle, one of a handful of white members of the Atlanta chapter, says the shift is inevitable.
The colors of our skins is politicized, sadly. Gun ownership is politicized, sadly. The idea that an African-American gun association would be blithely silent on matters of race and gun ownership would be absurd.
And then there's 57-year-old Army veteran Monica Neal. She says she got serious about firearms and self-defense after her divorce. Neal adds that NAGA elevating its voice might actually bring more black gun owners out of the shadows and into the organization.
When others see that, you know, we're for protection and for gun ownership, I think maybe it would more than likely increase our numbers.
Phil Smith, the national president, says the organization's executive team is discussing if and when to launch the PAC. Once group leaders finalize a decision, the 30,000 rank-and-file members get to have their say as well. Bracton Booker, NPR News, Atlanta.
Word masters. Word masters.
We're about to discuss sensitive words and why we decide to stop using them. For example, one word used to be a standard schoolyard insult. We would not say it today without this warning first. It is the word retarded. Now, some people say the words crazy and insane should fall into the same category. This came up recently when our reporter NPR's Netta Ulaby was chatting with a friend.
My friend and I were talking about something. I don't really remember what. And she said,
"It is so crazy."
I called my friend, Zarina Zlami, to reconstruct our conversation because she did something then that surprised me.
And then I stopped myself and I was like, oh, you know, I'm trying not to use that word to describe negative situations.
Much in the way that many people now avoid using the word retarded. This reckoning with the word crazy began similarly among disability activists and is trickling into the mainstream. Asa Altrafi researches disability justice issues at the Center for American Progress. Crazy might seem harmless, she says, but she thinks giving negative value to crazy or insane contributes to marginalizing people.
1 in 5 Americans, at least, have lived or experiencing mental illness. And of those people, we're talking about your neighbors, we are talking about family members, we are talking about people in your community.
People at higher risk to be hurt, homeless, and discriminated against. But isn't not using the word crazy a little bit, well, crazy?
She's the crazy ex-girlfriend.
What? No, I'm not.
She's the crazy ex-girlfriend.
Rachel Bloom created and starred in the TV show Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. It's widely respected among disability activists because of its depiction of a lead character with mental illness. Bloom thinks it's completely fine if people want to stop saying crazy.
That makes sense. I get it. It's a really, really complicated word. It has so many meanings. I think for me it's still contextual.
Obviously, there's no language police that'll force people to stop saying this word. It's an individual choice, says Zarina Zlami.
I miss the word sometimes.
But she's embracing not saying it as an intellectual challenge, as well as a chance to be more thoughtful.
And as, you know, an English professor, I also felt the burden of like, well, you know, I should be able to be more specific. When I say something's really crazy, what do I really mean? Like, it's really stressful. It's really busy. But as you and I talked about, those words don't really have the force of saying like something is insane.
It might feel unrealistic to lose words with such force. I asked Asa Altrafi what she would say to the people who are rolling their eyes right now at the notion of rethinking crazy.
What it tells people like me is that my life is not worth that adjustment. And if that is where people are, then it's really no surprise that people living with mental illness face such disproportionately high levels of violence and harm.
Language is living, she says. And using language that brings more dignity to people with mental illness is maybe not such a strange idea after all. Netta Ulibi, NPR News.
I want to be a cop.
Millions of Americans who have never committed a crime have their faces in government databases. That's because they have driver's licenses. And today we're learning that federal law enforcement agencies have regularly been accessing those DMV databases for facial recognition scans. In a moment, we'll hear about the broader issues this raises. First, we are going to look at one specific case. Late last year, an activist group in Vermont called Migrant Justice filed a lawsuit alleging that migrant dairy farm workers in the state were being targeted for deportation after they got driver's licenses. Jay Diaz is an attorney with ACLU of Vermont. He's representing Migrant Justice in this lawsuit and joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
What evidence do you have that ICE is using DMV information to assist with deportations in Vermont?
We have a great deal of evidence. The DMV routinely communicated with ICE throughout 2015 to 2018. We have emails between ICE agents and DMV agents, some commending the DMV agents and calling them honorary ICE agents. So they were sharing a good deal of information, particularly about migrant justice members, but also a whole host of other individuals.
And it's not just photos. It's other information beyond that.
Photos, applications for licenses, licenses themselves, car registration materials, the works.
And they were being selective with what they passed on. In one document your lawsuit uncovered, a state worker passed along what he described as south of the border names to ICE.
That's right. As alleged in our complaint, we believe that ICE used the DMV in order to target migrant justice members and more specifically and more broadly, I guess I should say, the Latinx community. So people who came in and were applying for driver privilege cards, I guess, would get special attention from DMV at the time. And a lot of those people would then be forwarded on to immigration officials.
We should say laws vary from state to state. In Vermont, undocumented immigrants are allowed to have driver's licenses. The flow of information from the DMV to ICE seemed very informal. Is there supposed to be any kind of oversight for this sort of information sharing?
Well, we would like to see oversight for the information sharing. And in fact, we asked for it for a number of years. We went to the legislature. We spoke with DMV officials. But unfortunately, we were not able to get the response that we needed to in order to protect immigrant communities from being constantly in fear when they were going to get a license that they would be then targeted by ICE.
Can you tell us a specific story about an immigrant who got caught up in this?
Yeah, we can talk about Kike Balcazar. He's a migrant justice leader. He has been outspoken. He's received numerous honors from various national organizations for his activism. After being pulled over by ICE, he was told that they got the information through DMV and through other sources. We went back and looked at our records and saw that the DMV gave his car registration, license, and photo to federal immigration officials, and that that information was actually used as the justification to arrest him. We know, of course, that his activism played a key role in that as well.
If an undocumented immigrant came to you today and said, I could really use a driver's license in Vermont, should I go apply for one, what would you tell them?
I tell them what I tell immigrants now, that, you know, it does come with some risk, that it's an important thing to get if you want to drive legally, but it also does come with the risk that the information could eventually end up in the hands of ICE. We're fighting to stop that right now, so stay tuned. We hope to get a good resolution through our lawsuit, but the issue is still pending.
JTS, thank you for speaking with us today.
Thank you so much.
He's an attorney with ACLU of Vermont representing Migrant Justice in its lawsuit against ICE, the Department of Homeland Security, and the Vermont DMV. NPR reached out to all three for comment. DHS and the Vermont DMV said they don't comment on pending litigation. ICE told us they don't comment on investigative techniques, but they point out that Acting Director Matthew Albenz has denied a previous claim that the agency targets individuals.
Holiday peals and nightmare groans. Bells ring and politicians preen as the 4th of July comes around. They and their corporate media all hail the day as a celebration of universal liberty, that essential thing that makes America, America, a place of freedom, justice, and, of course, the American way. But let us not dig too deeply. for the American way is more than a myth. It is a lie of deep and monstrous proportions. For as millions feast on burgers and hot dogs, thousands of refugees sit on floors, sleep on floors, and when thirsty, are told to drink out of toilet bowls like dogs. As millions light firecrackers, thousands, if not tens of thousands, try to rest in dirty clothes that, like their very bodies, haven't been washed in weeks. This is how thousands of Latino migrants, men, women, and children, are welcomed to America, the land of liberty. They are cast into private detention centers, camps, yes, where even babies are caged. This is how the grandchildren and great-grandchildren of the refuse of Europe treat migrants from Latin and Central America, itself an appendage of Europe. The richest nation in the modern world cages thousands, hoping they'll quietly go away. They groan amidst cheers of American triumphalism and wait in silent rage and anger. From imprisoned nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Context of white supremacy. Gusty Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, July 13, 2019. So I have been told. This is our weekly compensatory call-in. Dial in if you have questions, suggestions, thoughts on any of the news clips that we just heard or anything else that happened over the last 7 days. I generally say that is just kind of a small sample of some of the things that happened on the global plantation that is the system of white supremacy. There are many, 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 many other things that happen directly related, indirectly related, can't always play everything. I said repeatedly, because I had audio clips that were talking about what happened with R. Kelly. I got the was getting the audio segment together and said, wow, am I really not going to play the R. Kelly clip? I've got it right here. Am I not going to play any? And I guess I didn't. I'm certain that many listeners, certainly not all, but many are aware of what happened with R. Kelly federal indictments this week. He was already had already been arrested and was facing local charges in the state of Chicago. Now federal charges, I think in two different locations, but wow, I would say that is definitely going to be the definitive conclusion of civilian life for Robert Kelly, unless I am in error. One thing that I did think was significant, it reminded me of our yoga retreat back in February. Robert Kraft, the suspected racist white male, he's the owner of the New England Patriots. I think at the same time, on the same day, that Robert Kelly was charged locally, state charges up in Illinois, same time that Robert Kraft was accused, charged with the prostitution back in February. This time around, all the brouhaha about Mr. Epstein, same time as R. Kelly, just noting a pattern. Anywho, the number again is 605-313-5164. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. That number again, 605-313-5164. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Few things before we get to the callers. I believe Ivy wrote in maybe within the last, or excuse me, she called in within the last month or so And she asked for suggestions dealing with menstrual cramps, any suggestions. I am a male, so that is not my area of expertise at this point. However, I do what I can to share. I think within a few days of when she asked, Dr. Ruby Lathan was on the program and she gave some of her recommendations. Staying in motion, I think, was one, in addition to what you're eating, what you're not eating. She talked about that in detail when she was with us a few weeks ago. One of our listeners heard that archive and she wrote in. She said, greetings, Gus. I've not written in a while. I hope you're doing okay. Still write poorly. I'm writing because a few weeks ago, a caller, Ivy, asked for suggestions for relief for cramps and problems with digestion. I don't know if this will help, but I recently discovered this and it's been helping me. I watched a lot of Dr. Layla Africa, former guest, lectures, and I've also looked at a few other sources. I think cramps come from not using the bathroom enough or not getting it all out when you do go. During menstruation, your body is cleaning house and too much waste causes pain. First off, digestion starts in your mouth, so make sure you are chewing your food properly. It does take longer, but I found that when I rush through a meal, I get an upset stomach. Try to space out your meals. I give myself 3 hours between meals, snacks. This can be difficult. Drink anything when you're eating. Drinking anything when you're eating interrupts digestion, so eat first and drink after. If I eat a heavy meal, take digestive enzymes after. Be sure you are drinking enough water. Echo. Start over with that sentence. Be sure you are drinking enough water and or tea to keep hydrated all day. Nothing is a substitute for water. Dr. Lathan talked about that as well. Put yourself on a schedule to make sure you are going at least once a day. Once you start monitoring your movement, you may find that you need to go more than once. Suggestions, if you have difficulty going or keeping the schedule, it is easier to go 30 minutes after you eat. Squatting or raising your knees when using the bathroom is the way you are supposed to be going. Squatty potty or a stool. Squatting helps you to have a complete bowel movement and can prevent hernias. Sorry if this is too much information. Hey, Dr. Lathan talked about that as well. She talked about reducing transit time, making sure that you're going on a regular basis. You should be eating and then going to the bathroom to relieve yourself at some point afterwards. It should not be that you're not going at all during a 24-hour period or having long periods of time from the period after you eat to when you have to go to the bathroom for a bowel movement. So this is pertinent information, and a lot of people's health problems are directly related to not drinking enough water and digestive issues. And I have even seen multiple reports that not drinking enough water, that can also cause problems with digestion. Continuing. Personally, I found that exercise and diet are important, but monitoring my bowel movement has helped me the most. I've also found that the women that I talk to about cramps tend to have trouble using the bathroom. Lastly, using pads or tampons that are natural makes a huge difference. I hope I was clear and not too confusing. I am a victim and still learning. Me too. Thanks, Gus, for all your efforts. Much obliged. Thank you for the information. That came up before. If other folks have suggestions, feel free to share. Drinking water. Other notes to share before we proceed to callers again. We are listener-supported counter-racist radio. Invest if you think the program is constructive. You can visit my blog, racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. When you hit the blog, PayPal button is in the top right corner. Much obliged to all the folks who have supported for a decade plus. I hope the context of white supremacy continues to be worthy of your time and energy. If you're not into PayPal, we are also on Cash App now. Listener just admonished me to make sure that I'm on Cash App as well. We are there. You can visit cash.app/$thecows. Cash.app /thecows. You can also just drop us a mailing, or excuse me, drop us an email if you are not into all of the 21st century apps and gadgetry. Drop an email and we can get you a physical mailing address if you would prefer to use snail mail. Much obliged. Tremendous gratitude to all of the investors who have kept us on the air for 10 years. I hope the cows has provided accurate, constructive information on what it means to be classified as white, what the system of white supremacy racism is, how it works, and things that non-white people can and should be doing to solve this problem immediately. You can also visit my wish list at Amazon.com. It is under Gus T. Renegade. I think Amazon Prime is coming up. If people are going out to do shopping, load up, do some spending for that, you can nab constructive items that are noted on my wish list. It is listed under Gus T. Renegade at Amazon.com. It is also linked at my blog right beneath the PayPal button. Thank you kindly to all the folks who have nabbed items from the wish list. Support is extremely appreciated. Next, the commentary about the water. That was one of our new segments this week. We just had a listener yesterday on workplace racism, where he talked about how he's drinking more water, has lost weight, is feeling better, eating more fruits and vegetables. They in that clip from the BBC talking about the connection between drinking those non-water sugar-filled beverages. Sometimes they don't even put sugar. They go the cheap route and put all that high fructose corn syrup. That'll kill you right quick. They put all that nonsense in it, and it's hot. I mean, you're going to be thirsty. Those drinks, whether it's sodas or even the fruit drinks, none of those are better than water. Today I had, and I cannot because I got a purposely small glass, so I had 4 ounces of kombucha green tea, and everything else was water. Consistent. That's what you want to be. Not sodas, not slushies, not Slurpees, not any of the other nonsense that they will offer. Water, if you can get it without lead and formaldehyde and everything else that they put in the water that they're going to serve up to black people, non-white people, if you can just get uncontaminated water, woo! Outstanding self-respect, and that is outstanding self-care. Drink lots, lots, lots of water. Next, right in line, I guess, the segment that talked about the legalization of cannabis and looking at some of the different studies and how it impacts the brain. I thought that was interesting about people who consume cannabis perhaps being more impulsive. I'll have to ponder on that one and just give a thought. If anything, it reminded me everything that they talked about that in that segment. It immediately reminded me of the grandsester, Dr. Frances Cress Welsing. She was on the program. I can't believe it's been 6 years. She was on the program in the summer. It might have been 6 years to the day. I think it was 6 years to the day. I think if I look back, it might even be that that was on July 13. I know it was 1 week after the murder trial, murder of Trayvon Martin, in the summer of 2013, where she came on the cows and she talked about all things related to white supremacy racism, and she brought up her views on what you heard in the segment, legalization of cannabis, and she said that she had a number of black patients, third generation physician general and child psychiatrist, who had become psychotic as a result of cannabis consumption. She talked about, hey, you don't have a lab, unless I've been misinformed. You don't have a lab. You haven't done any analysis of that cannabis product that you're about to consume to see what's in it. Has it been altered? Yeah, as just said, you can't even get water where they have contaminated and put this in it and put that in. You can't get Brussels sprouts where they put Roundup on it or some kind of fertilizer or craziness. Why would we think that the cannabis that they provide to us would be pristine? I always think that's something to seriously consider. In exactly as the grandsister said, analyzing behavior in context. Continuing, We talked about the ice cream liquor case from last week. I was a black female. At the time, when I heard about this last week, and listeners did, some of the callers were talking about this last week. At the time, I think they had said that it was a black female. I didn't know that this was a minor. I think the Young Turks, they reported that in the segment. I've seen a number of different articles where they have identified this young lady and had her name out and everything. That's another one that you can kind of compare and contrast when a white urchin has committed some sort of crime. I don't care what the crime is. If they're accused of calling someone a nigger, we've had lots of those. If it's some other type of criminal activity, theft, shoplifting, whatever it is, compare when white minors are accused of a crime and black minors. Now, you got a black female here, licked a container of ice cream. Hey, I enjoy a vegan ice cream every now and then. I certainly do not want to get one that someone has licked on. However, in the system of racism, white supremacy, where you have a black female under the age of 18, child, where they're talking about a 20-year sentence, unless I was misinformed, they're talking about the possibility of a 20-year sentence for this young lady and identifying her, where you have the young lad identified as white, where he raped somebody and they said, oh, that's, you know, affluenza. Give him another chance. He's a good lad. Good lad. He wants to go to school and get his life right. Just to compare and contrast. And I think people were saying last week, because of this incident, it got so out of control. They were stationing enforcement officials next to the frozen ice cream. They were putting those sensors where it's like a black, I guess, something either that beeps or you have difficulty taking the container off of the ice cream. I just thought, wow, that the time, energy, and resources that white people can invest in something that they think is a problem when they are serious about addressing that problem, as opposed to the time, resources, and their response to racism, white supremacy. They can do things right now to make sure nobody will violate another pint of ice cream this summer or any other summer. We'll handle that right now. The system of racism, white supremacy. Hand-wringing. Next. The segment on Justice Clarence Thomas. It's, wow, that he's been on the bench for 30 years. They described, they said that, I guess some of his peers, colleagues, describe him as wacky. Supreme Court Justice, the longest tenured Supreme Court Justice out of those that are actively on the bench right now. And he is wacky. Anyway, I listened when they talked about some of the decisions that he has dissented from, specifically the case with the black male in Mississippi, where he's been tried six times by a white prosecutor who deliberately is removing the black jurors. And Clarence Thomas is one of the few who dissented in that opinion. I think that is consistent with his track record over the 30-year period. I know they talked about previously, I guess, earlier in life, they described him as being a so-called Black Panther type, a radical, whatever that means. That's how they described him. I don't think he's been described in that manner since he's been on the bench. Anyone who is upset about that, the people who are most to blame are white. I love that audio clip from Mr. Neely Fuller Jr. where he says, hey, system of racism, white supremacy, if the most powerful whites, if they pick out Clarence Thomas or any other individual classified as non-white and say this will be the designated black spokesperson from the Supreme Court bench, from the White House, from the governor's mansion, or wherever else we choose, that's what it'll be. But Clarence Thomas is wacky. In addition, the segment where they talked about words and reconsidering the use of crazy, retarded, all of the whites recognize the power of words, what you call things, how you describe people. I would hope with this broadcast and people who study and recognize the significance of counter-racist logic, an enormous component of that is about words and just being mindful about what we say. They have a number of segments that happen on NPR and even other news outlets where they regularly examine the use of words, the use of words in the so-called press, and just how everyday folks speak, communicate with one another. I would encourage an even greater level of scrutiny for attempted counter-racists. A major component of what we do and going about this work involves words and just monitoring how other people speak, what words they use, monitoring how you speak. What would be the best words to use? What would be words to avoid and why? Always important. I hope we are on our job with that consistently. In that spirit, this program, the compensatory call-in specifically, I request that people not use metaphors, analogies when sharing your thoughts or views. Suspected racist white supremacists, they have a very successful record of employing similes, comparisons, analogies to insist that you have two separate entities, but they're identical, almost exactly alike. And frequently, that is not the case at all. Victims of racism, myself included, we've been exposed to this misconduct for a long time. Many of us are still learning. Our caller that wrote in said that. And sometimes we just haven't come to a conclusion. So we are missing logic to articulate fully our views. And so sometimes we'll substitute a metaphor, a comparison of some sort. Frequently, that just produces a lot more confusion. If we could make an effort to be direct, explicit about what it is that we would like to say, that would be great. I will prompt about that. Let's be mindful of what we say. Thank you kindly. Also, similarly, if we could take about 5 minutes to share your thoughts or views, that way everybody has at least one opportunity to share. If you have additional thoughts or questions, if you could wait until everyone has spoken at least once, and then if you have additional commentary, shouldn't be a problem. We'll make sure that we hear from you again. Also, if you know that you are in a noisy environment, if you could please use your mute button, just helps to preserve the quality of the broadcast. That way we don't have to compete. If you have other people talking in the background, if you're someplace where there's a television or something playing in the background, just use your mute button. Then you can unmute yourself when you are ready to talk and or share. Much obliged. Number again, 605-313-5164. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Let's see. Last thing I'll share before we get to some of our callers. I did have a grand moment of black. Oh, I have two. I forgot. Wait a minute. Boop, boop, boop. Number one, the yoga. I forgot all about that. People that are in the Seattle area, or if you're going to be visiting the Seattle area anytime over the next month, basically on into the middle of August, myself and two other non-white people, one black female, one non-white, non-black male. We will be teaching yoga in the park until next month. I taught this past Monday. The weather cooperated. It was a beautiful summer day in Seattle. We were at the park. Everybody that I taught was black except for one person. It was just absolutely awesome. It was, in fact, I can pick out two moments to share. There was one moment. We're supposed to be there. The goal of this is to try to encourage other non-white people and especially non-white families to participate, get exercise in the summertime, come out, hang out at the park and do yoga. That's, you know, one of the main goals to try to encourage. So pretty much everybody, I think that I was telling to come out and, you know, let's come do some yoga. It's free in the park. Come do this. Was black people. I think I told one non-white, non-black person who happens to be a non-white yoga instructor that I know. But other than that, I told exclusively black people. So we went out. It was awesome. It was lots of young children who were there. One of them was even there before I got there. He was excited, like, let's do it. Let's do some yoga. And he was young, too. So he laughed. He's a black boy. He was like eight, nine, really young folks. I was a little surprised that they were yet that young. I was thinking they were going to be closer to like middle school, high school age, but they were way on the tiny side, like 10, 8, 9, that age group. Anyway, so we do the first session. We're there pretty much most of the afternoon. We do the first session. I teach the first session. And everybody's great. They enjoy. We have a good time. We take a little break in between, clean up a little bit. I'm running around because we're at a big park. Kevin Durant built a really nice basketball court from when he played here in Seattle and have a big playground. So I'm over playing with some of the children, non-white children that I came with. Wait a little while. Black father comes over. He's there with his son. He says, oh, man, my son, he plays football. Brain damage right there. But he plays football, and I'd love for him to get some stretching in. Are you teaching? He can come practice. You say, sure, bring him over just when you're ready. Let me know, and we'll go get started for our second session. He came over. We had some other moms. They wanted to come in and join us, get some stretching. It was outstanding. And then later in the day, it was a black mother. She was there. Her son, he was in one of the first groups that we did. I think her son, he was like 8'2". Anyway, she comes over and she says, oh my gosh, my son, he was so happy and he came to do yoga with you. And this is just the best thing ever to be able to have yoga in the park and to make it accessible. And this is just wonderful. It's like, that's glad to help. You know, we'll be here for the next month, you know, come back and you can do more yoga. But it was totally awesome. It was like, that is exactly why I wanted to teach yoga, to be able to share with other black people, and even just them being able to see the person who is here to do the yoga. Black male. Ah. Love it. It also, if, as I said, if you're going to be here every Monday, so this coming Monday, it'll be happening. I will not be teaching this Monday. Black female will be teaching. Should be great. If you want to hang out 1 to 4, you can drop me an email. We can give you the directions, where it is, all that. Not this Monday, but next Monday. So that would be the 22nd of July. I will be teaching once again, so if you want to come hang out, if you're in the Seattle area, do a little yoga, would be grand. It is free. You don't have to bring anything. There are yoga mats provided and all. And then I'll be teaching again, as I said, the 22nd. And then again, I guess that's the first Monday in August. I'll be teaching again. I don't know what date that is off top. I'll have to look at the calendar, but I'll let people know. Again, if you're going to be in the Seattle area, on a Monday, anytime over the next month, and think you want to come do some yoga in the park, let me know. Untiljustice@gmail.com, and we will make it happen. Additionally, I've been working on the details to get everything complete for our Florida yoga retreat. Drop an email if you're interested. I'm going to send out all of the details within a few days for the trip, dates, times, expenses, what will be happening, all of that, location. if you have any thoughts, I'll give an opportunity for feedback if there are things, additional things that folks think should be included or any other input to try to make it better. I will send out so people will have time to do that. But I'm looking forward to see if we can make this happen. Florida yoga retreat for the end of the year. Again, drop an email if you would like to make sure you are included and do not miss out. That said, number again, 605-313-5164, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Definitely make sure, before I forget, we spent so much time discussing Hurricane Katrina and the white terrorism, both before the toxic floodwaters and subsequently. We spent so much time discussing that. I think some of our signature work here at the program, I'm certainly aware of, I think it's Hurricane Barry now, heading towards Louisiana. I hope our listeners down in the Louisiana area and any other regions near the Gulf where we have COWS listeners, victims of racism, I hope you all are doing everything that you can to take safety measures. If that means evacuating, I know that they did evacuate some areas. So if you had to evacuate or just voluntarily evacuated, or if you chose to stay and just wait it out, Stay as safe as you can. Take it seriously. Certainly remember Hurricane Katrina. It's not just the storm with these situations, unfortunately. You had a lot of racists who also caused a lot of problems during the 2005. I was going to say fiasco, but that seems like minimizing during the 2005 abomination that was Hurricane Katrina and all that followed. So be mindful and take every safety precaution that you think is needed to keep yourself as safe as you can and anybody else that might be in your care. But certainly thoughts, prayers to folks down in Louisiana and the Gulf region in general. *61, if you would like to participate, first few folks who dialed in, if you have a hand up, commentary to share, line should be open. Feel free if you would like to participate. Yes, ma'am. Your volume is a little low. If you could speak up or get closer to your receiver, that would be grand.
Can you hear me better now?
Awesome. Yes, ma'am.
Hello, this is Red in Nevada. I just have a few things I wanted to, or a few observations, what have you. First, on the clips, I was confused about Supreme Court Justice Thomas being described even previously as a Black nationalist and them kind of relating it to his decisions. I guess I never read any of his jurisprudence about, especially when they described, about any of his dissenting, I don't know, rules or whatever. I'm not sure about the judicial terms, but when they were describing him dissenting, him being the only dissenting one as far as the Black male who kept being tried because he kept having all white jurors, and they made it seem as if Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, that he was dissenting because he was wanting to give defense attorneys the opportunity to have all Black juries, which I don't even see how that's possible. Maybe if someone else knows of any information or any evidence that they can point to as far as where they got that correlation from, I would definitely appreciate that. But I thought that that was definitely something that may be fictitious at best. When in the Young Turks clip, they briefly, when they were talking about the whole ice cream licking thing, and I did see the video. I also thought it was interesting how I don't feel like they blurred out her face, but that also goes to, that also reminds me of another video where over the 4th of July, there was some Walgreens that was broken into, and it was primarily or only non-white Black youths that were rushing into the store, and I forgot what network that I saw it on. I was looking online, and none of their faces were blurred out, and that made me think about that as well. Like, you have so many different white school shooters or even other white urchins, and yet their faces are always blurred out, whether male or female. I remember the one in California. It was a white female, young white female. Her face was blurred out after shooting something up, but with the Young Turks, they briefly described a judge. They didn't say his name, I don't think, but his name is James Toriano, T-O-R-I-A-N-O. There was also, I found another relating article about another judge in New Jersey, Marcia Silva, and she also looks to be possibly white. And they both were declining to try 16-year-olds for the rape of either another 16-year-old, the white woman. She wanted to not try a 16-year-old for raping a 12-year-old. She has said that she didn't feel the 12-year-old was emotionally or physically or any other way damaged.
But I thought it was interesting in the article that I read, and the article is from, it says it's from globalintel.com, but you kind of have to scroll down. But basically he's saying, basically Judge Toriano, he was describing his description of rape, which is just kind of paraphrasing, rape. It would involve either two or more, generally males, either at gunpoint or weapon, clearly manhandling a person in an area where there was no one around, or an abandoned house or an abandoned shed, shack, something like that. I just, you know, thought that that was interesting, that it has to be that specific for it to be rape. But, you know, with white men, they just, you know, make up whatever rules that they would like to. The last thing that I'll mention, and the article is from last week, and it's actually about the CRISPR technology, and the website is called newscience.com. And it was basically discussing the, I'll just read the title. It says, five couples lined up for CRISPR babies to avoid deafness. And this was something that was attempted to be performed or done or what have you in Russia. But the Russian scientist, he has not yet gotten the permission, because he was trying to test, he found five couples that he wanted to try to test the CRISPR technology more. And that article is dated July 4th. And I'll meet my line. Thank you.
Much obliged, Red in Nevada. I know we've talked about the CRISPR technology quite a bit over the years on the program, even talking with Dr. Welsing about all that. She talked about that at her last Welsing Institute lecture. I am pretty certain I'd be willing to wager, I was normally say a nickel, I'd be willing to wager quite a few quarters that those five couples who are volunteering were not black people. I could be wrong. I don't know if that sort of those types of really elaborate surgeries tend to be very pricey and exclusive. We've talked about this as well. All of the fertility breakthroughs and new drugs that they tend to come up with, that science generally is reserved for individuals classified as white, and them staving off white genetic annihilation, those types of things, not for black people. And to see that we're having more healthy young black babies full of melanin and ready to come out and do spectacular things in the 21st century, that is generally not what we're about. I also thought that when you were talking about the rape definition, so females can't rape. I know Dr. Curry talked about that in the Man Not. According to that definition, you have to be a male for it to be an act of rape. Like, wow, that's, he talked about that exactly, having a definition of rape that already excludes females from being capable of rape, which is simply not accurate. Other folks who dialed in, if you have comments, questions you would like to share. Oh, I guess I'll also get in quickly. Some of those dissenting opinions or different times where Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, where they make it known that, oh, yeah, we had a case. I'm trying to back in 2013. I think anytime that they have one that deals with racism, you just heard the one where it's a black male in Mississippi and he keeps getting tried six times. They had when the civil rights case came up, I think that was 2013. Generally, anytime something dealing with racism, white supremacy comes up, you can almost guarantee that Justice Clarence Thomas will have an opinion that goes against whatever it is that's saying, oh, racism is a problem, we need to do something about that. He is not going to take that position. It's generally going to be something opposite, like what Red mentioned. We want to make sure we don't have, you know, all black juries. I've never heard of that. I don't know where it would be possible to even think that it, you could maybe you can swing it and we can get an all black jury. I have no idea. Maybe if people in Atlanta think it would be possible, I don't know. Continuing, other folks who dialed in, if you have a hand up, proceed. If we have anyone here who has ever seen an all-black jury, please let us know. Other folks with a hand up, let's hear from you.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, Traptomania. Yes, ma'am.
Greetings, Gus, and callers and listeners. No, I have not ever seen all black jewelry. I don't think that would even be possible. I'm not sure what I was listening to. I think it was Michelle Alexander or something I was listening to, and they were talking about how it would be difficult for us to have all black jurors because of the way, because of white supremacy, how this system disqualifies black candidates for jury duty, because most of us are perceived as criminals, so they don't usually take us as serious candidates in order to be what are the jurors. So that number would be very slim, I would assume, as long as the system of white supremacy still exists. Today is my born day, and what I did today, I ended up taking a day off work because I was supposed to work today. I decided that I was going to do something constructive for the day, and what I ended up doing is I treated myself to the International Civil Rights Museum. And I'm going to the museum.
Your line is breaking up a little bit. It's not as clear as it was when we first started.
Okay. Can you hear me now, Seth?
Give us another sentence. Let's see.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. So what part did you...
today's your born... Let's see. Today's your born day, so you decided to treat yourself to...
The International Civil Rights Museum. And it's not my first time going to the museum, but this was my first time ever going on tour. And it was very, very interesting. They took us through the tour of, different events would then happen at Woolworth and the sit-ins and, school history. And the tour guide, she was very good. She was very knowledgeable about white supremacy, racism. There were Caucasians on the guide also. And I just tried to, have a serious tone about me because, she was showing the pictures of the, they were showing the pictures of the lynchings, and I forget this young man that they ended up lynching. They took him out of the jail, and they lynched him. They burned him, and all the other things that they did to terrorize them. Do you remember what his name was, young man that they ended up pulling out of the prison, out of the jail, because they were trying to give him a trial, but they took him out of the prison, out of the jail. Do you remember what his name was?
No, ma'am, because that's, or at least to me, it's so familiar. There's so many cases of that nature that have happened, particularly in the 1900s, of them snatching a black person, a younger black person, snatching him out of prison and taking him off to lynch him. It's just, the book At the Hands of Persons Unknown, that's like a 500-page mm-hmm. book, and I'd say about half of the cases are just like what you just described, a young black person, a young black male being snatched out of jail by a mob of white people and lynched.
Wow. I just wrote that book down. I'm going to research that now when I have opportunity. But like I said, it was very educational, and I thought it was very informative. We had an opportunity to just go through the whole civil rights movement, and, it was just, I just felt like I wanted to do something that was constructive for today. And I had an opportunity to like check myself out to a big restaurant also. I got a healthier choice and, you know, I enjoyed my day by myself, and which was pretty good. I wanted to make some comments on some of the things that you, some of the clips about the medical marijuana. I feel like marijuana, if it's used for medical purposes as opposed to using the opioids, I think it could be beneficial. I also know that abusing marijuana can be addictive. I know from my own experimentation and from other people's experimentation. I also know of someone that smoked marijuana, a couple of people actually that smoked marijuana, and it was late, and they kind of went into I guess you would say, like Dr. Francis Press Wilson said, she said that people have gone and they never came back. I knew I had a classmate like that, and I had a friend who's a son. I think somebody must have laced his marijuana, and it made them, they still, I don't know if this is a metaphor, but they still.
Your line is breaking up again?
Oh, I'm sorry. Can you hear me?
Still breaking up a little bit. It was better for a while, and then it seems like it got a little bit worse. I don't know if you moved or maybe some interference with the phone. Let's see it again.
Okay, I was saying, can you hear me better now?
I can hear you. I can hear you. Let's see.
Okay. I was saying I knew some people, a couple of people. One guy that I went to school with, he smoked some marijuana. Not sure if somebody put something in his marijuana, but it's like he ended up being like nostalgic, like a distant point where he was never right again. And I had another friend who's son.
Yeah, your line is still breaking up. I can't really make out what you're saying now.
Okay. You want me to call back and maybe try again?
Yeah, let's do that. I'll be looking right at the switchboard. So if you hang up and dial right back in, I can boop, get your hand and we'll see if that fixes the problem.
Okay.
Groovy. We'll look out for Draftomania dialing us right back to hear her observations about cannabis consumption, whether or not that has caused any problems. I'll see if I can make a note so I can remember so we can go back to where she was when she rejoins us. While we are waiting for Draftomania to ring us right back, other folks that we have missed completely, if you have a hand up, proceed.
Hello. May I be heard?
Greetings, Irie, dialing in from Louisiana. Hope you are safe from Hurricane Barry. You and all the folks that you care about, concerned for, are safe and dry.
Yeah, thank you. Good evening, everybody. Thank you, Doug. We left. We got up out of there. Not playing around just in case, you know, it didn't go as they were, you know, showing the trajectory. There was really bad flooding in the middle of the week throughout parts of the city. Many water spouts, sightings, a tornado that actually almost touched down not too far from where we live. And we never had weather like this before. I just want to let everybody know the weather that Louisiana, I can't speak for Mississippi, Alabama, or Texas, but we never really got weather so sporadic and torrential in the past. And it seems like it really started to me around 2003 or 4. I remember having to evacuate at least twice in 2004, and the storm ended up going another way. But before that, we would experience tornadoes,
And I'm like, since when? Since when does New Orleans get tornadoes like that? And now they're getting weather that I believe, based on my learning, is comparable to what they experienced in the panhandle of Oklahoma, Tornado Alley. And, I feel like I know I could say this because I hate tornadoes. So I studied them so I could know how to avoid them, whatever. And this is the weather that we're getting now. So something's going on. Don't know if it's global warming, cooling. It could be global tampering, because if they're messing with the sun, then perhaps this is a causation. But I want to say, in regard to the storm, it's really something to look at. And all white people should be ashamed, no matter who they are, because white people allowed government entities and agencies to receive $14.6 billion to reinstitute the levees to withstand a storm. And the levees have sunk. They're supposed to be 14 feet. They've sunk down to 10 feet. So we have a serious and glaring case of fraud, waste, and abuse. And I believe white people are complicit in the misuse of these funds. And I also believe that they're not serious about creating a new levy system that works, because I think they're trying to, that's a metaphor almost said, I think they want to try to do their best to cause population dislocation to the black people that did go back and claim their place after the storm. There are a lot of people coming in that don't, they want black people gone, or they want black people to be just there to serve them in a variety of ways. And I don't think they're going to fix the levees until they feel like New Orleans is purged of, an unnecessary black population, whatever they decide that to be. That's my speculation. And then I also wanted to add really quick that the cannabis situation, the United States, in my outlook, again, I'm still learning, created a situation comparable to prohibition. They took away the alcohol, and they took it away for years and years and years, creating a frenzy, because for some reason people want what they can't have. So you had instances of what they call bootlegging throughout the country. There was mob involvement, government involvement, and just regular people doing it. And then all of a sudden it was legal. But it was legal by the time the people that have the power, who are probably all white men, decided we're divvying up the alcohol industry. You're going to be Anheuser-Busch. You're going to be Miller. You're going to be whatever, da, 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 da. I do believe that's how they've done the cannabis industry as well. It has great benefits for some people medicinally, and I would never stop somebody from wanting to heal. But at the same time, if they're tampering with GMO seeds, foods, whatever, you might as well assume they're tampering with the cannabis, and this is just another ploy to make money one way or another, and black people are not supposed to be making money off of cannabis. And that's why it's so hard for black people to get dispensaries. For instance, Charlo Green. So I'll end my turn there. Thank you very much. We're safe. We're fine. And I hope everyone else is safe this evening as well. Thanks.
Much obliged, Irie. So glad to hear from you. And even more thankful that you are safe. I said voluntary evacuation. Do whatever you think is prudent to keep yourself safe and other folks that you are charged with caring for. Nothing to play with down in that area. And I think that is logical in terms of whether it is climate destruction and or deliberate white interference or a combination of both. I've seen so many reports all the way back to 2005 with Hurricane Katrina about inappropriate use of funds that were coming into that area that were supposed to be to make sure that, we don't have that sort of catastrophe again, and didn't work out correctly that way. I think the only person that I'm aware of who ever got charged with anything was Ray Nagin. Said my man got free gravel and other nonsense while he was mayor of New Orleans, but I'm not aware of anybody else being prosecuted where they had to do some jail time or was facing 20 years like the ice cream liquor. Anywho, as I said, be as safe as possible. I'm glad to hear you studying the tornadoes. Mr. Fuller did encourage, learn something about everything. If I was a resident in that region, I would be like I wouldn't say full time, but at least a substantial amount of my hobby time, as they call it, would be devoted to studying hurricanes, weather patterns, how it's changed in this region. I would be an amateur meteorologist. If I lived in that area, that might be a part of counter racist code, and just so that I feel like I can do as best I can to keep myself safe. Other folks who dialed in, if you have a hand up, be on the lookout for Draftomania as well. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, I'm sorry, Jess. Okay, so this is Draftomania again. Can you hear me better now?
Much better.
Oh, okay, great. I'm so happy to hear that. So as I was saying about the marijuana, I had a classmate that smoked some marijuana. I'm not sure if it was laced with something, but he was never to be the same afterwards. It was like he would stare out into space and would barely like speak. It kind of reminded you of like a Thorazine shuffle type of situation. And then I had a girlfriend who's son smoked some marijuana, and he was never right also. And also another thing is when I was listening to Michelle Alexander's The New Jim Crow, and they were talking about how all of these black men were locked up in prison and given she's a cowbell, huh? And she has a parent that's also, yeah, so I think so. But anyway, they were given unjust time, which is to be expected in this system of white supremacy, giving black males all this time in prison for having small amounts of marijuana. I think they were saying, well, one case that she described, there was a gentleman, it was due to the three strike laws Bill Clinton had wrote into made the law. And because of these inmates or these gentlemen that already had some charges against them, when they had when they got caught with like a 9-bag of marijuana, they ended up getting maybe I think life in prison, or possibly like 20, 30 years or something like that in prison. So there's like tons of black men in prison right now that are doing major time for marijuana. So I think that, you know, I'm not sure what they're going to do about with all of this legalization of marijuana. What are they going to do about the inmates, black inmates, not white inmates, that are in prison right now and doing exorbitant amounts of time? Are they going to let them out now because this is legal? Or, you know, what's going to happen as a result of that? In regards to the child trafficking, I think that's horrible. And, you know, this guy, I think, are they going to do the same thing that they're doing with R. Kelly? You know, he basically, you could consider him as a pedophile. And it's true when it came to reporting this.
Your line is breaking up again. Looks like a concerted effort to make sure we do not get your R. Kelly commentary. That's about the point where it became a little difficult to hear you.
Oh, sorry.
Let's see. Are you still with us, Draftomania? Not hearing you. concerted effort, not trying to let us get Draftomania on her born day, as they say. We will see if we can work it out. I'll be looking for you if you switch the lineup, or you can speak up and let us know if you are.
That's what I'll do.
Okay. As we're trying to figure it out, I'll get one other person while we're waiting to see what the issue is. Constant interference on Draftomania's line this evening. Other folks who dialed in, if we have missed you, if you have commentary to share, line should be open. Proceed. Wow, folks, so wait, let me make sure I get out the number again, 605-313-5164, the code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. I'm not sure what the deal, I don't think there's been any other folks that I've heard, at least today, where it's been that consistent of an issue with the phone. I don't know. I don't know what the deal is, if it's a phone issue or if you tried the Skype line, but we'll try and figure it out. Excuse me. We'll try and figure it out with Draftomania so we can get her back in with us, whatever the issue is. I guess we'll try it again if you switched it up, Draftomania.
Yeah, this is me. Can you hear me now?
I can hear you now. It just sounds low. I don't know if you... If you can turn your volume up, or just make sure you're speaking at the phone, but your volume just sounds very low now.
Okay, hold on. Okay, so what I did take it off of the headphones. How does that sound now?
Sound clear now? Let's see if it stays that way.
I really believe that it is interference from the people, you know. So I was saying in regards to the child trafficking situation, that this guy Einstein, it just seems like, these types of guys, they end up doing this predatorial behavior to individuals or women, little girls that have problems in their childhood or at home, like they said in the report. He was targeting girls that had issues at the home, where they were runaways or in foster homes, any type of issues. And it leaves you to be open to those types of advances from men like that, because, you know, they have money and they're offering you things. And, you know, so, I mean, it's very unfortunate. And what I was saying is that I doubt if they're going to end up treating him or giving him federal charges like they're doing R. Kelly. And we haven't even heard anything back from Weinstein. We haven't heard anything else in regards to charges being brought up on him. If I'm not mistaken, I think they said the lawyers made sure they took care of Weinstein, where he won't have to worry about any type of, further charges or anything being brought up on him. But I guess we'll see. It seems like his case has been hushed. We haven't heard much about that. And in regards to the Black Gun Owners Association, I think it's very important, and I think it's an act of Black self-respect for us to arm ourselves and to protect ourselves. It's a part of our amendment, right? In regards to them taking a political stance on it, I think that it can have negative effects because it may, as the young lady was saying, it could draw, attention, unwanted attention. But then I can also see how they want, to have some type of political input also. But I'm not sure if they should maybe take a separate stance on that, doing it along with the Gun Owner Association. Maybe they could, do that separately, because it may be considered as you know, some type of, I guess, black nationalist militant group if they go about it in that manner. I could see that being an issue. And the little girl that was doing the licking of the ice cream, that's another example of, you know, the racism, white supremacy in the law, and how they're going to charge this little girl. And that was other examples, like just in Michelle Alexander's book also about like petty little crimes like this. But when it comes down to non-white black people, we end up having to do all this exorbitant amount of time just for little, you know, for licking ice cream. And then you just contrasted that with the, you know, suspect that raped a girl on videotape. And because his daddy had money, you know, he's not going to probably even do a day in prison. So that's basically all I had to share. And I'm glad that, you know, I had an opportunity to speak. And thank you so much for being patient with my line. Although they've been messing with my line and didn't want me to talk tonight. So thanks, Gus.
Yes, ma'am. Draftomania, context of white supremacy. Some days perseverance is the word. Reminded me, Mr. Clarence Thomas, Justice Clarence Thomas, I wrote about this before, where they talked about his dissenting opinions. Sometimes they'll be unfavorable. This is 2015. I'll have to post it. And this is not, at least directly, not related to racism, white supremacy. But 2015, around this time, that's when they had the Supreme Court decision about gay marriage. And they got the big win, whoopee, for the LGBTQ team, right on. Clarence Thomas was one of the dissenting opinions on that one. And he got so much just really ugly flack for his dissenting view in that case. I remember George Takei, he's the non-white male on Star Trek, Asian male. He called him a blackface buffoon. He called him a clown. He just came out and called him all these really nasty, in my view, racist names, to call him a buffoon and blackface. I think it was even some other white people came out and called him Uncle Clarence on social media. And this was like a white elected official, I believe, in like Minnesota or Michigan, called him Uncle Clarence and all this other. But this is a regular thing. People come out and Justice Thomas will give these opinions that a lot of people do not agree with, and they'll just use, oh, no coon on the bench, and all that. I've seen tons of victims of racism will do this as well, sometimes encouraged by whites who do the same thing and just name call him and act like it's all his fault, or if he voted in a majority opinion, it's all his fault that the court got this decision wrong. Standard, just to have one black person there for 30 years just to be fussed at, ridiculed, and described as wacky. Cowbell there too. I totally forgot. Other folks who dialed in that we have missed complete. I think Mr. Thomas does have an autobiography. I think that was one that I at least had thought about us doing in the book club. Have to think on that for a bit. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, *61 if you have comments to share.
May I be heard?
Greetings, caller in Florida.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners, and callers. I was paying attention to some of the words that were in the audio segment. I think one was where that may have been the Young Turks segment, where they were talking about the ice cream story. And I think that was Sink that made the comment about someone's going to get ice creamed or whatever. And I know that a few years ago, a while ago, the term cream meant like someone being injured or hurt or defeated, like somebody got creamed. Okay. And then in a visual sense, you know, cream is something that's visibly something light or white. And ICE, especially like how ICE is an acronym for some kind of organization of law enforcement or government that's going to seek out non-white people en masse, I guess, or what's called people who are called migrants. And what you were saying about how white people are very meticulous and they are highly focused on the use of words and acronyms, anagrams, all kind of ways of figures of speech. And I think the word edgy was used, and I like to use that. I'm not going to really try to get into a metaphor, but I use Google as a means to see what visuals and images come up when I type in a certain word. So I keyed in edgy, and I just seen that usually it refers to someone's, I guess, attire, or the style of attire that they wear, and the color usually seems to be something dark and black. And I seen a picture of the word edgy, and the edge or the outer line of the word edgy was in black ink or whatever. So I don't know, maybe that can be a word to be on the lookout for in the future. And what I also noticed was that in the segment about, I think that was the sex trafficking case with the white man, and that might have been a white woman that was speaking, where she went in to say that specifically it was white men with quote unquote privilege and power. It should have just stopped at power, who take advantage of, and she started using words like, I guess, maybe disadvantaged or marginalized groups. But she never really got to the racial aspect of it. Like, are these non-white young female children or children? Like, what specifically? In regards to the, I believe it was the case about the R. Kelly, I believe. I don't know if that was mentioned, but I did notice how that came about as soon as the, I think his name Epstein or something, how that pattern seems to come about, and they got to hurry up and put a black male story to cover and to conceal what white people do in mass. So that's all I have for now. Thanks for allowing me to share.
Much obliged, caller in Florida. The word edgy, I am going to have to pay attention to how that term is used on a more consistent basis, one I hadn't given much thought to previously, but I will be more mindful of that one in the future. The segment they were talking about, Mr. Epstein, and they were saying how widespread child rape is. I think that's another one we talked about before. Say it that way, using the term child rape as opposed to sexual abuse of minors. They'll try to find other ways of making it not sound so disgusting. Reprehensible. Child rape is widespread, and they said that it's frequently white men. As I said before, their definition of rape, it is not exclusively males. You have some raping white women out there too, but I thought that was important. I agree they could have left the privilege part out. It is powerful white men, and then put a period on it, or if you want to add in powerful white men frequently and white women. Period. And then they do this and take advantage. They use that term marginalized. That's one that's on my list where I've recommended before people not use the term marginalized. That one, I was alert because frequently they'll use the term marginalized when they, instead of saying niggers, they'll say marginalized populations. Instead of saying victims of racism, they'll say individuals who've been marginalized. They didn't say that Mr. Epstein and these other powerful white men, they didn't say that they were specifically targeting non-white people, although I am totally sure that that exactly could be what they're doing. They talked about it was rumors about the same thing with Jerry Sandusky. If folks recall, back in 2011, he was up at Penn State saying that he was doing the same thing, taking advantage of marginalized young children. He was going out to do his child rape And there was exactly the same foster care. He had that whole foundation to go out and get all the little children that he wanted to rape and take advantage of. In the shower, we had guests on the program, white guests even, who were saying that they were targeting specifically black children. Black babies cost less. We don't care about them. They're just going to grow up to be ice cream lickers and rapists anyway. So, yeah, go out and do all the raping you want. But I thought that was also important from that segment as well. Powerful white men and white women. You certainly have non-white people who engage in this behavior as well. But I don't think the R. Kellys of the world are going to have networks like Mr. Epstein where they can do this and then get a real easy punishment and get off and make that a matter of practice. I don't think that black people have that sort of power, ability. I could be in error. Bill Cosby. Other folks who dialed in, if you have comments, questions you would like to share, lines should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
How's it going, everyone? This is a black male engineer. I kind of missed all the calls, the earlier clips and everything, but I'm not sure if this was ever talked about, but I read an article about a white woman who went to Uganda and ended up killing over 100 children because she posed as a doctor, and she was performing medical procedures, surgeries, giving the kids medicine, and she ended up with over 100 children dead. She's an American white woman. When I heard about it, I just thought that it was crazy that I don't want to blame the non-white people, but then it just goes to show how, like, a white person would, like, if a white person says they're a doctor or says they do anything, they're just automatically assumed to be telling the truth. And, you know, we've heard so many stories about non-white black females and males on, like, airplanes and in situations where there are people who are in need of immediate medical attention, and they're trying to explain to people that they are medical professionals, nurses or doctors, and no one believes them. And, you know, the person just about almost dies until the last couple seconds. They're like, all right, well, we'll let you work on them. You know, and I don't know, just stuff like that just makes me really angry. And I can't find the words for those kind of actions. Well, that's really all I have today.
Do you remember, much obliged for dialing in, sir, black male engineer, do you recall how the children were dying in this instance, or?
Yeah, actually, let me see. It was, so she was part of one of those NWOs or
NGOs,
NGOs, those organizations that like to go to Africa, parts of Asia to quote unquote help. And let's see. So she was giving medication to the children. No one knows what the medication actually was. But I was reading supporting articles about how NGOs, those organizations, they give pills and medicine to people in Africa. And when they actually test out the medicine, find out it's just pills of bleach. Like, they're literally just giving them bleach in pill form and saying it's medicine. So there was that going on. she was giving intravenous lines, you know, IV fluids to infants. She wasn't trained, so who knows what kind of stuff was actually in the IV. She was performing surgeries as well. And it's, let me see. I'm trying to find anything more specific, but pretty from what I've read, she was really just giving them bad medications. She was trying to diagnose them when she didn't. So, you know, she was diagnosing people who were sick, but she has no knowledge of what to do. So a lot of these people were sick and they just ended up dying from complications from their illnesses. She was giving them like bleach pills and bad medicine and performing operations on them.
Wow. Much obliged for the detail. That I think is a correct comparison, where it's not, I'm going to take these two separate distinct instances where this white woman, race soldier, goes to the continent and allegedly has killed about 100 black children. And then I think one of the recent cases that was one of those this year where I think it was a black female medical professional. She was on a plane and trying to assist someone who seemed like they were having a medical emergency. And it was, wait a minute, nigger, what are you doing? Putting your hands, who are you? You a garbage worker? What? Let me see your credentials. And she pulled out, and I don't know. And the woman or person who was in need of assistance is about dying. And they, I don't know. Got this nigger here claiming to be a doctor. I don't know. Do they have nigger doctors? It's 2019. They went through all that. Excellent comparison. I would say in a system of racism, white supremacy, though, and I think anytime when you have non-white people who have been thoroughly terrorized and thoroughly robbed, where they are in dire straits, and especially if you have a child who is in, you know, horrendous condition, I think many, many victims might not be as suspicious under those circumstances. They might be, hey, anybody, if they can do something to help my child, let's see what they can do. Let's see if they have, you know, something, if they have medication or something of that nature. I suspect it would just be a lot of victims. They just would not be thinking that someone so diabolical would be coming to kill an already sick and ailing child. So I think that's, and I think we talked about that with the gift of violence, that you have predators, and that's what it sounds like this woman was. When you have predators, they are extraordinarily skilled. Gavin DeBecker, he went over all those techniques, how to be charming, how to be nice. You show up and you have on your clean white doctor's uniform, and, oh, I got some extra food, and this is our course of action, and all that, where you can sound super convincing, like, oh, things are going to be great. This white woman just told us our plan and blah, blah, blah. I mean, system of racism, white supremacy, it is very, very easy to take advantage of and terrorize us victims worldwide. Unfortunately, that's just another sad illustration, unfortunately. Other folks who dialed in, if we have folks that we missed totally, number again, 605-313-5164, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate.
Probably heard.
Greetings, Thomas in New York.
Greetings, Josh. Greetings to all the callers. Great show, great clips. They call Clarence Thomas a megalomaniac. Megalomania is a mental illness. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Oh, okay. I'm hearing a lot of background noise. Megalomania is a mental illness. People with megalomania have delusional fantasies that they are often more relevant or powerful than they truly are. They have inflated self-esteem and overestimate their powers and belief. The word megalomania is no longer in use in the mental health field. It's not mentioned in the Diagnostic Statistics Manual of Mental Disorders, the DSM, or the International Statistical Classification of Disease, the ICD. Instead, today they call it Narcissistic Personality Disorder. Okay, so the definition of a narcissistic personality disorder is a personality disorder in which the person is obsessed with themselves. They think they're better, more important than anyone else, wants to be treated special, more common in men and women. and they give 9 bullet points as to identify people with this disorder. Very high self-esteem, 1. 2, often imagines being extremely successful, powerful, brilliant, and beautiful, or in love. 3, believes they are special and unique, thinks they should only be around others of high status. 4, needs to be admired often. 5, they should be treated better than, thinks they should be treated better than other people. Others should want to do things for them. 6, they exploit people. 7, they do not have empathy. 8, they're envious of other people and they think everyone is envious of them. 9, they're arrogant. To me, this disorder describes white people. Every one of those points is them. Every part of this disorder, they also call it, they have illusions. Delusions of grandiose delusions. Another name they use for this disorder. And this is the people that we deal with on a regular basis. I disagree with Mamiya. I think he was taking a emotional stance on immigration, not a realistic one. We all know that whites come here from Europe. We all know what they did to take over this country. And we all know they're in charge of the country. There's no equity in a system of white supremacy. He could look at his own circumstances and see that. So we live in one of 195 nation states around the world. And one of the few things you have to do to be classified as a nation state is you have borders. And the people in charge of the nation state get to determine who could enter those borders. I don't think that it's like rocket science, you know. And I personally think keeping out people from the areas of the world south of the United States is better for black people that are here in the United States right now. I don't see how that's making our circumstances any better. In fact, I could name millions of reasons how that's going to make our circumstances much worse. Licking ice cream. To me, licking, opening a product, and putting your body fluid on it, or spitting in something, that's a felony. It should be treated as a felony. It's a crime to me as close to anything as terrorism. Is that you don't know what people have. I don't feel sorry for the people at all. That was stupid. I think Ariana Grande, I think she started that when she went overseas and licked the donut. She should have had her tongue cut off. Like, that was disgusting. And I think that, you know, they should be treated hit with the fullest extent of the law. That was nasty. What were you thinking about, you know? Registered sex offender, child molester, Jeffrey Epstein. I think he should share a cell with serial killer of black men, exclusively, Ed Buck. They'll be perfect cellmates. I picked up one of R. Kelly getting locked up the same week. Federal charges, which means that the federal, if you have the feds on you, that's a 93%. They have a 93% winning rate. You pretty much can't beat that. You know, it's very difficult. They got everything they need when they come get you. No loopholes. You know, it's pretty clear cut. I just think that Jeffrey Epstein, he's been arrested for this before, he's continued to do it. And I think he'll be free. And at the end of the day, R. Kelly will be in prison. And I'll mute my line for now. Thank you, guys.
Much obliged, indeed. Rocket science, that is a metaphor. And I think actually being able to list a million reasons, I think that would be a metaphor too. Hyperbole, they might call it. I don't even think Trump and the wall people could actually write out a million reasons why that wall has got to go up to keep those potential rapists, drug sellers, to keep them south of the border. Other folks who dialed in if we have missed you totally. Number again, 605-313-5164, the code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. We have less than 30 minutes remaining. So if you have a comment or question, if we missed you completely, do not wait till the last minute to share.
Yes, can I be heard?
Greetings, retired firefighter.
Greetings, Gus, and greetings, everyone. Start off, I don't know if you played it or not, the report where the white male cut the throat of the young black male. It didn't seem to get a whole lot of publicity, but nevertheless, I think something of that nature in forms of terror mistreatment, in somewhat like a bowl instance, will become more and more popular. South Florida, Broward County, the BSO chief that was appointed by the white racist suspect governor of the state of Florida has been firing white people. But then again, in this recent case, the what appeared to be a white person that got fired, he obviously was on tape punching a black male that was handcuffed, and he was hadn't even gotten a year on the job. And to fire someone who's on probation is pretty easy to do. You know, you can get fired in probation just for spitting on the ground. So basically he was an appointed figure. Another dynamic thing about this, non-white black male who's the police chief, his wife is his partner in their private business. From my understanding, has been pretty much used around the country, some sort of security business. She's a white female. That was a additive on why he was selected. Also, one thing that was ironic about the white male that he fired for punching the black male, I believe that this was the same person that sold the weapon that the Broward County killer at the high school, I think Marjorie Stoneman Douglas killer, used to kill the teenagers. This was a person who sold that white person, the gun. And at just how recent it was, everybody can understand what I'm saying. He joined the police department and was accepted. And within a few months, he was fired for punching a black male that was handcuffed. Today's report, DCS program, we made our annual field trip to boot camp, which is essentially we went to the largest jail facility in Miami-Dade County. I believe it's called TGK. I keep mixing up the initials of the jailhouse. But anyway, still, like I said before, still processing on the reasoning on why we are going to a boot camp From the popular diagnosis is that this scares the young people, so they would not want to go to jail. But I think under the global system of racism, white supremacy, that has a lot to do with the process that controls environments that places non-white people into confinement on a global scale, and also a lot of us end up also being in what Mr. Fuller calls greater confinement also. And that has to be really dealt with in order to solve our problem. But one thing about it that was kind of like positive is that there was a question and answer period. Although the all of the people who were in this boot camp program appeared to be non-white, there was a few that I didn't really know for sure, but I would say 99% of them were non-white black males. As the black males were asking questions, the drill instructor, as he called himself, would call one of them up to answer the questions. And that sort of, it's kind of like in a very strict military-like way. And I would have liked to have been a situation where they spoke more on a natural basis. But nevertheless, that's what they do there. And, you know, they had a question and answer period. So I thought that was good, although it could have been much more placed in a much more natural fashion. I asked some questions to a couple of the correctional officers who was in the program. One of them was how would you be disqualified into not being accepted into this boot camp program? And I said, if you harm someone physically, would they be eligible for this program? And he said, yes. And I said, well, but to what degree of harming somebody? I didn't really get a good answer on that, a specific answer on that. Although he did say, no, you would not qualify for this program if you murdered somebody. And also, you wouldn't qualify for the program if you raped somebody also. But basically, that's what we did today in the program itself. It was a couple of young people that kind of like had to leave the area. So I guess in that light, it affected them in that way. But like I said before, I think all in all, the best preventer of the global system of racism, white supremacy is greater confinement is to deal directly with the global system of racism, white supremacy. And thanks everybody for listening, and I'll continue to listen. Thank you.
Much obliged, retired firefighter. I think those types of programs, the boot camp thing and having some quote unquote adult person stand up in front of some younger people and yell and talk tough and you're going to wind up here and all. I think they've tried that for a while. I've even seen some reports where they've said that it seems that that sort of thing is not as effective as people would think, that sometimes the young people just end up thinking, oh, wow, how cool. I want to come here so I can be one of the tough guys and, you know, show them how tough it is. Like, sometimes I do think just having direct conversation, the young people can ask questions, you can explain things and just have a general discussion. I generally tend to think that that might be a bit more effective than just, yeah, the typical.
You're right. I did ask about the retention rate, and one of the officers was honest enough to say it is rising.
Not surprised. That is the system of racism, white supremacy. But all in all, still grand to be able to invest some time to help out some young folks and spend some constructive time with them. did not play the report about the white male suspected racist slashing the throat of the non-white male. We'll make sure to share, include that one. That did not get as much attention as Mr. R. Kelly and or the ice cream liquor from this week. Or last week, I guess the ice cream thing was. Other folks who dialed in, if we have comments, questions, if we have anybody that we missed, totally, definitely make sure you get your hand up. Do not wait till the last minute. If you have something that you want to share before we wrap things up, we have about 15 minutes before we conclude. If we have anybody who has an extra comment, question, suggestion that they would like to offer, as I said, about 15 minutes before we wrap, now is the time to speak up.
Hello, may I be heard one more time?
Greetings, Irie.
I wanted to add really quick. I was watching a video on automobile accidents, some kind of compilation, because I don't know. I just want to see what happened, what each driver did wrong or whatever. And there was a driver that I suspect to be white. I didn't see the driver because he had a forward-facing camera in the car capturing sound and visuals. And he was listening to some type of radio show in which I heard the host say to two other people. So it sounded like one white male and one white female. Well, two white males, one white female. And he says, well, you know, white people aren't going to give up doing blackface. And they're like, no, they're not, not ever. He was like, so why don't we just pay black people to put on the blackface? And I just was like, I was like befuddled completely. I guess that's a metaphor, but I was speechless because I couldn't believe the person added the video or that they posted this video with that audio, you know, you can hear it, but then at the same time, I suppose, why wouldn't they? So I just thought that was very, very interesting. And there's been a lot of terrorism over the past week and month, or summer, I should say, in regard to young black males. And I'm doing my best to make sure my son lets me know where he is when he's not with me. We use Messenger to share locations. I'll even share mine with him if I'm, you know, doing some late driving. But I make sure he updates me on a live location every hour if he's not near me. It's been very, very scary and stressful. Thank you. Good night, everybody.
Much obliged, Irie. Having that safety plan, being an attempted parent, is a lot of work. But take it seriously. That terrorism against black people is ongoing. I would say about television programs, they generally have editors. Things generally do not end up on television, or if you watch it on YouTube, whatever the entertainment section is, or crazy car chases, any of that sort of thing, you generally have a lot of people review that footage before it gets posted online so that it can be streamed, as people watch it on TV. So I am sure some other people putting that project together heard that segment, and they could have decided. I mean, they could have muted that. They could have took the audio out. They could have talked over it. They could have lowered the volume so you couldn't have heard that. Apparently, they wanted that included in the segment. And again, white people are not ignorant about racism, white supremacy. They're listening, preparing for automobile. Let's hear it.
I apologize. It was a creator channel on YouTube, so it was to the discretion of that person, I suppose you would say.
Oh, okay. Well, even still, I mean, that would be at least one editor, even if, you know, this is the most low tech and they got maybe five subscribers. I don't know if it was a white person or a non-white person who put all this together. But if it's somebody who's classified as white, it would still be they edited. I'm sure that they had to watch that project to put all that together and post it online several times, as someone who's done a little bit of video editing. So I'm sure they heard all of that. They could have made the decision to leave it out. put it in, turn the volume down, lots of things. I know they even got fancy editors where you can remove the audio completely and you still have the video that you want to show for the automobile accident. But the main point, as you said, white people are not ignorant about racism, white supremacy. And I mean, that's just, that's their casual listening. I don't know what this person was doing, but that's what they're listening to. Blackface, the Coon Man. Yes, not going to give up that blackface. Doing the Michael Jackson and all the rest of them, Drake, anybody else. That's what we'll be doing, dressing up, doing our blackface performances. System of racism, white supremacy does not take holidays, does not take breaks. White people are dedicated. Get in a car accident and then we'll go and do blackface for that too. Get Tracy Morgan, or we'll pick out a famous black person who had a car accident and dress up like them. Other folks who dialed in, if you have other questions, comments that you would like to make sure that you share before we conclude, go ahead.
Yes, can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, I was just I'm looking at the internet, and I didn't know. It's saying that New York had a power outage. Midtown, New York, Times Square, Hell's Kitchen. They had a large outage. And it, let's see, it said it began to began to hear reports that all restaurants had gone dark in Hell's Kitchen around 7 p.m. Saturday evening and 42 years to the day after the famous 1977 blackout in New York City. But the power has evidently been restored in that area. But I was not aware of that. Were you?
I wasn't, but, you know, I'm 3,000 miles from New York. So, yeah, I don't claim to be an I hope Thomas in New York. I hope he's doing well. Apparently, he still had enough juice to be able to dial in for us. But, yeah, I was not aware of that. I can't even really say I'm that surprised. New York had a power outage in 2003. Around the same time, unless I'm misinformed.
Really?
Thomas in New York, were you there then? Didn't they have a big power outage in 2003? Summer 2003?
Yes. One of the worst days of my life. Oh, yeah. I'll never forget that one. Yeah. Oh, yeah. They're having a power outage. So trust me, it's not affecting black people, okay? If you black and can afford to live down there, and you deserve the power outage too, okay? That'd be you spending $8,000-$9,000 a month rent. You know, you could afford to stay. But they, you know, white people, they went outside. They was held their cell phones up in the sky. I mean, they made a party out of it. They do what they do. But yeah, I was there for two. But the whole country, Gus, it was Chicago was blacked out. Philly was blacked out. That was huge. This was just a small piece of Manhattan. It affected, you know, a few 100,000 people, but they be all right.
Much obliged. I thought Thomas had already shared. He would have said something that they were struggling and thinking it was going to be difficult times, maybe Armageddon type thing for the weekend until the electricity is restored. But yeah, that just means NYPD will be a little more aggressive on that part of town, maybe. And I guess it's been restored, so yeah, back to normal, no big deal. Yeah, I'm not surprised, but no, I did not know about that at all.
Yeah, me either. Yeah, like you said, Thomas would have said something, but yeah, they're gonna be all right. It's up in Times Square and Midtown and Manhattan, so yeah, they'll be okay.
To retired firefighter, just really quick, he had mentioned about the white terrorist. Who slashed the throat of a black male child. This was from July 9, which is just a couple days ago. A white man followed a black teen into a store and cut his throat because rap music made him feel unsafe. I'm going to stop before I even read. This is exactly what I'm talking about with the gift of fear. This is white people every day. The thing that they say they are most afraid of invariably. Niggers. That's exactly what I said on Thursday. That's exactly why I started with the clip that I did. That's my major thought for the whole book. Why it's so popular, why it's celebrated, why Oprah Winfrey is interviewing him for the 10-year anniversary of the book. I think it's coming up 22-year anniversary of the book now. But this is it. Anything. Nigger looked like he had, you know, was coming in and listening to rap music. That's the same thing they said about Jordan Davis. Negros came into the gas station and had their loud music on, so I had to shoot and kill him. It's always, it doesn't matter. He had a paperclip. Said she was a doctor. Made me unsafe. I thought I had to kill a few of them. The report reads, it was in the early hours of the morning on Thursday when police say 27-year-old Michael Adams entered a Circle K convenience store in Peoria, Arizona, inside with 17-year-old Elijah Alamin, who his parents say had just gotten off a late shift at Subway, one of his two summer jobs. Man, I don't even want to read anymore. It's lazy black people is the problem. You got a black teen with two jobs, not one. He wasn't out at night partying for the summertime. He was getting off from Subway and got killed. But anyway, got his throat slashed. Excuse me. Continuing, Adams, who had been released from prison 2 days earlier, allegedly approached Alamin from behind while the black teenager, a rising senior in high school, stood at the soda machine. Adams then took a pen knife out of his pocket, stabbed Alamin in the back, and slit his throat, according to a police affidavit. Alamin staggered out of the store and collapsed near gas pumps as witnesses unsuccessfully tried. Oh, he did. When Adams was apprehended by police shortly after, he said that Alamin had neither said nor done anything to threaten or provoke him. Adams explained he had attacked Alamin because he had heard him playing rap music in his car in the Circle K parking lot before going into the store, which made him feel unsafe. And I'll just post the remainder of the article. Arizona. Racism, white supremacy, omnipresent. Did other folks have comments that they wanted to share? Last 5 minutes.
I thought Jordan Davis, too. And I also thought, because the guy who got killed, he looked like he could have been a result of an Area 8 relationship. I thought of the young man in Utah who was dressed up in the anime outfit, and he got gunned down. It might have even been by law enforcement, but, I mean, obviously, dressed up in an anime outfit, you know, they had to kill him. You know, something's wrong with him. I just want to say, on the eve of this potential hurricane threat, in Louisiana yet again. I often hear people say that they're not creating some of these storms. So they have a patent, U.S. patent, 3517505A. That's 3517505A. It's the method and apparatus for suppressing contrails. So the stuff coming out of the back of the planes are not contrails, okay? They can suppress that. It's been like that since 2011. All planes have this apparatus. It's against the law for them not to have it. So if you see something coming out the back of a plane, it's not a contrail. And on 1947, they had Project Cirrus attempt to stop hurricanes by dispensing silver oxide into the eye. They tested it on Hurricane Daisy in 1958, Hurricane Esther in 1961, they realized that it didn't slow the storm down and strengthened it. In 1962, they had Project Baton, B-A-T-O-N, and you can look these projects up. They were creating the storms that in the desert in Arizona, creating the storms out of nothing. You know, just taking the atmosphere, changing it, creating hurricane-like conditions in the middle of the desert. In 1965, they had Project Storm Fury, and this was the one. This created Hurricane Betsy. This was Katrina before Katrina. I think Lyndon Johnson might have been the president, and he actually went down there and was had famous pictures of him helping black people out. Bush did the opposite during Katrina. But they created that storm during this Operation Storm Fury, Project Storm Fury. You can look it up in 1965. And then you have Operation Popeye, which lasted from 1967 to 1972. And this was during Vietnam, where they would create typhoons and monsoons to come in off the coast there, just perfecting their craft of creating these storms and directing them where they wanted it to go. So I just wanted to keep that in mind, and I'll meet my line, Gus. Thank you.
Much obliged, Thomas in New York. The effort to conquer nature itself, contaminate and destroy everything. We talked about that in Dr. Marimba Ainee's Yorugu, first book that we read on the Cows Book Club, 2012. We basically have done our full 3 hours. I will again say for Irie and all of our listeners down in Louisiana Gulf region, hope everyone stays safe as possible. If that means evacuating, if that means hunkering down, if you have your supplies and are confident that you're in an area that will remain high and dry and that you can stay safe, whatever you think the best procedure protocol is, do that and reevaluate if needed. But take every precaution to keep yourself safe. And again, it's not just the water. We are in a system of racism, white supremacy. So it wouldn't just be the storm. It would still be racist man, racist woman, racist child. And it's been my experience when it's a chaotic situation, that's when race soldiers can really wreak a lot of damage because racists, they already have a network. The system of white supremacy is the network. So they're able to communicate, organize, much, much better. If that's unjust networking, coordinating for incorrect terrorist activities, and or if that's coordinating to do correct things, at least look out for each other, or if they have some extra time to look out for other folks, then they can do that as well. But they tend to be much better prepared for these types of situations than victims of racism. So I hope everybody in that region take excellent care of yourselves, and we will check in soon. Much obliged to everybody who participated live. If you listen to the archives, I hope the broadcast has been worthy of your time and energy. I will again encourage sobriety would be best. We heard in the audio clips, we heard it from listeners, drink more water. We do not need any narcotics, poisons to help us get through the power outage or anything else that is happening. Drink more water. In addition to being hydrated with water, every time we get in a vehicle, passenger, or driver, let's be buckled up. Let's do every possible thing that we can to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no. Easy. When we get in that vehicle, click. Just because we are not looking to be stopped, harassed, ticketed, all the rest of it, for things we can easily put a halt to. That would include not being on the cell phone when we are driving. Again, just trying to take out the little things that they use to terrorize and just cause us unnecessary problems. With that, yoga in the park in Seattle. If you are in the Seattle area, drop me an email. I will be teaching not this coming Monday, but next Monday. I'll be teaching again July 22nd. If you want to come out, practice, do some yoga in the sun, drop me an email, untiljustice@gmail.com. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other Black people, victims of white terrorism. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of Black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another Black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cow signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, your brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.